of 107 during the month. We are just now, over the last few days, starting to see a leveling off in the high 70, low 80 arena. And from our conversations that we've had with the county, that does appear to be consistent. So we're keeping our fingers very crossed that things start to slow down a little bit. Our JFK facility has also had a pretty healthy census in COVID plus care. They've been running at about 45 ADC. So overall, what we're seeing in the hospitals is we're actually seeing less patients presenting for care, but we are seeing those individuals that are being admitted staying in the hospital for a longer length of stay, which is actually driving up our average daily census above our normal baseline levels. So both at JFK and at Desert, we have found it necessary to seek quite a few supplemental staff through traveling agencies, fast staff agencies. As of today, between JFK and High Desert, we brought on 103 travel fast staff nurses. We have an additional 64 that have been interviewed, accepted, and are in the process of onboarding. So over the next few days, they will be joining us, which will bring us to about 167 additional nursing and respiratory, I should mention, summary respiratory therapy resources. You know, our staff is getting tired, and we are concerned that COVID is going to meet flu towards the end of this year. So we, in addition to the 167 nurses that we brought on board, and they are brought on board on a 12-week assignment, we do have approximately another 100 individuals that we're in the process of recruiting, so that we can sustain what we think is going to be, you know, a pretty long journey here between COVID and the traditional flu season. So in addition to some of the people resources, we've been keeping a step ahead here on onboarding some of our equipment needs. So we have purchased an additional 75 PAPRs. And we do have an order that's going in for JFK for another 50 PAPRs. And we have been increasing our ventilator and our high flow capabilities as we are watching and managing the numbers and where we're seeing a bit of an influx. Both JFK and High Desert, as well as the other facilities in the valley and several throughout Riverside County and Orange County, we did submit to the California Department of Health for a staffing ratio waiver, and we have both facilities have been granted those requested staffing facility waivers. That doesn't mean that we are going to intentionally go out of ratio. You know, we will make tremendous efforts, which I would hope the number of supplemental staffing we're bringing would show you that we are making to maintain in ratio to the highest degree possible. Primarily the areas where we have had to go to more of a team nursing or had some challenges on our ratios are in the med surg units, more so than others, but I'm not going to tell you that we have times within shifts and certain days where we have struggled to be in all ratios at all times as is the original intent under the California law. We have, given the numbers that we have, found it necessary to create a new position, which is called a COVID navigator. And that COVID navigator will have the ability to really, really keep a bird's eye view of what's going on in a house with our individuals who are being cared for that are COVID positive, and make sure that we have good line of optics on those individuals that are receiving convalescent plasma, those individuals who are qualified for remdesivir and some of the other treatment therapies. You know, you want to, there's, as it was put to me today, some of these therapies, you can't give them too soon and you can't give them too late. So you have to make sure that you're sort of, you're taking opportunity in that window of opportunity that may become available to you. I will tell you that, you know, a little bit to the conversation you were having earlier on test results, that we are finding that when it is necessary to use an outside lab, we likewise will experience the 5 to 7 to 10 day turnaround lag. We are fortunate to have in-house testing. We do use that in-house testing as availability of reagents allow, because we have a rapid test that's a 15-minute test, and we also have two instruments that do full PCR tests that give us more to a 2 to 4 hour turnaround time. But we do have to be judicious about how we're using that testing and how we're using those reagents, that prioritize those that that are in most need of an immediate result finding. On a couple of other issues, we did open the emergency room expansion, so that was 7 additional treatment areas in the new area. So that will bring us to 44 treatment locations, combination of gurneys, chairs, and recliner chairs. But we are going to do the best that we can, and actually starting Thursday, we're looking to take our MedExpress, which has 8 areas, down to be able to do some refurbishment, replacement of flooring. And I think I did mention to you before that it is our intent that as once we open the new space, that we were going to start to do some refurbishing of the existing space, and it'll have to be heavily phased so that we don't take too many treatment days out at any one given time. And it will take at least a couple weeks per each phase that we're taking down. But it really is necessary to repair some of the flooring and laminate and complete some of that work. The other item that I wanted to mention to you is that I think that you are aware that we do have both the California Nurses Association and the SEIU that represents a large number of our workforce. We are in contract negotiations with SEIU currently. They are statewide negotiations, and we have been notified by SEIU do plan to have an informational picketing event on Thursday, this coming Thursday, starting at 6:30 in the morning. And we have also been notified by CNA that they're going to be having another informational picketing event on August the 5th. And it's my understanding that event will be similar to the informational picketing event they had maybe 4 or 5 or 6 years ago. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Michelle. Is there any questions from any board members at this time? Yeah, I have several questions. I'll start with Director Zindel.
Yeah, Michelle, in the news recently, in fact, the national news, there was a report about, I believe, FEMA providers being sent to Eisenhower. Could you talk a little bit about what those providers are and why Desert Regional decided either not to ask for any or wasn't given any?
So I will share with you, to the best of my understanding, it is a FEMA team. There are about 6 FEMA teams that were deployed throughout the state of California. Eisenhower was one of the facilities that did experience an early surge, and so Eisenhower did go ahead and secure that FEMA team. It is comprised, and please don't consider this 100% because some of this is real. Honestly, what I have read in the newspapers, are comprised with approximately 21 individuals for 30 days. We have been successful in securing the traveler and FAFSA, nurses and respiratory therapists, which is really where our particular need is. And when we secure those individuals, we do look for a 12-week commitment. And so our preference would be if we can secure the resources that we know are here on a 12-week commitment, we want to go that way. That's not to say that if we ended up with issues and trying to secure those traveler staff that we wouldn't reconsider applying for a FEMA team, but right now we feel that the facilities are better served with the 12-week resources that we've been able to onboard. And I think the fact that we have either on-site or have secured contractual commitments for 167 individuals shows that we're in a good path. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. Yes, it does. Thank you.
Director Rogers, you had your hand up.
Yes, thank you. A couple questions. Does the hospital have adequate ventilators and PPEs for the staff and patients?
Can somebody repeat what Carol just asked, because she was breaking up on my line?
Sure. She was referring to if the hospital had enough ventilators and PPE. I guess.
Carol, we were concerned about ventilators, so we did rent and have on site an additional 6 ventilators, and we have 25 more ventilators on order. So we do feel that we're doing we're holding our own on our ventilators. I don't think I'm ever going to tell you we're overly flush, but we're holding our own and we're planning ahead for what we might see. Of the 75 additional PAPRs we ordered, we've already received 50 of them, and we are receiving an additional 25 this week. And as I mentioned, we have another order going in for an additional 50. So we have started to deploy those out to the unit. On PPE, there are some challenges with certain sizes of N95 masks, but there's a shortage on the small size. So there are other products that are available that we have been acquiring. Those products do require that we refit test the employees that will be wearing them. So there is a process that we have to go through with the different manufacturers and the different fit testing. We have had some requests from some of our staff to want to bring on site personal PPE and particularly what we call a half mask apparatus that is a reusable apparatus that has these external filters. And we have, through our subject matter experts, we have been advised against using and permitting those types of masks because they are not a bi-directional filter. They're a one-way filter. So you want filters when you inhale, the particles are filtered, and when you exhale, the particles are filtered. So thus far, we have not found any of these half masks that meet the fluid permeability requirements, the cleaning requirements, and the bi-directional filtration requirements. So we have not permitted their use.
Thank you. Next question is, I know that. Thank you. The I know that in our last discussion, you said something about the fact that how the hospital employees have a lower rate of COVID positive tests than the community. Are you doing testing on employees and at this time?
We continue to do look-back clinics twice a week for our employees, and we are running a positivity rate less than the community rate.
Great. Is it the hospital policy to notify employees of positive, employees that have tested positive?
We would not notify the staff of a coworker. We would notify the staff if they had an exposure.
Okay. That's good. Next question is, do you have a plan for increased ICU and medical beds that may be needed if we have increased patients that are admitted?
Yes, we have a surge plan document, and actually we've been working this week updating that surge plan document. The CDPH came out with new surge planning guidance, and they've actually, in their new surge planning guidance, have indicated the calculation that we run now to make a determination if we're in mild, moderate, severe, or critical surge. And so we are realigning our surge plan that we had previously done to comport with the new CDPH guidelines and criteria. I will tell you right now, we are considered to be in a mild surge.
Thank you. That was all my questions.
Thank you, Director Rogers. Director Perez-Gill, I can't see whether you had your hand up. Do you have any questions or comments to ask at this time?
No, I don't have any questions at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. I just have one question. I think my other question was already been addressed, but on the convalescent plasma that you mentioned, Michelle, do you have an idea of how many, what's the percentage of how many people are actually donating? Is there a feeling that that's actually a significant number and making a difference, or how is that working?
We have had some patients that have received the convalescent plasma and they have had good outcomes. But I mean, honestly, we've had some that have received convalescent plasma that have not had good outcomes. You know, I can't really tell you how the donations have gone. That's being done through Livestream. I'll share that we've done a number of notifications requesting individuals to donate for convalescent plasma. But I really don't know how many. We haven't had an issue of getting the convalescent plasma when we have reached out and had someone who's qualified. Mm-hmm. But don't take that as lack of encouragement for people to go donate.
Okay. Now, always a good message to send. Thank you very much for your report. And if there's no other questions from any board members, there is one question. Let me see. Can you clarify what the 75 ordered items were for, if not ventilators? I don't know what that question is meaning, but
when you go into a what's called an aerosolizing procedure, let me put it to you this way: you have N95 masks, which you wear when you're in a COVID positive environment. If you go into a room and you So you have a higher level of exposure. That's when you wear what's called a PAPR, which is a full head unit that has air circulation going on inside. And then if a patient is having difficulty, so that's what the staff wears. If the patient is having difficulty breathing, then your first course would be a high flow, which is oxygen, that's helping the person breathe. Then you might use what's called BiPAP or CPAP. And if that doesn't work, then you may have to get what's called a closed circuit ventilation. And that's when you go on a ventilator.
Thank you.
I'll let Dr. correct me if I got that wrong.
Okay, so I do want to mention that Linda Evans quoted Dr. Rick Axelrod, CEO of Livestream, that they have several requests for plasma donations and are working through the requests. I want to make that known to the public. Okay. Thank you very much, Linda. Okay, so the next item on the agenda is H, Desert Regional Medical Center Governing Board of Directors Report. Director Zendel.
Director Rogers and I attended the governing board meeting of July 17th. Much of the meeting is the CEO report, and Michelle has done a good job summarizing the main points. I just want to point out a few other things that occurred during the meeting. We had a very comprehensive annual report of the Comprehensive Cancer Center. We have a report every year, and the Cancer Center is really one of the jewels in the crown, if I can call it, of Desert Regional Medical Center. They had, and this is the 2019 report, they had 85,000 visits last year. And they did show us the monthly sort of year to date, and there's a precipitous drop off after the end of May, end of February, beginning of March. But then in April, the end of April and in May, it begins to go back up again. And they're doing a good job of making sure that their patients with cancer are being served. In addition, we had some usual reports, but I'll just mention it. The quality report, which the director of quality goes over in great detail, the quality measures that have to do with various things that are being measured in anticipation, not only of what delivers good quality care, but what LeapFrog and what the CMS agencies are monitoring hospitals on. And so the board receives a report monthly about how we're doing on those measures. And then finally, we had the medical staff report. And that is where we go over all the physicians, either that are new and have to be credentialed and privileged, or the biannual, or every 2 years, I don't know if that's biannual, I can't remember, re-credentialing of all the physicians. And we do the same thing for the non-physician providers, nurse practitioners, CRNAs, and physician assistants. And that was the meeting. Carol, do you want to add anything?
No, thank you. You did a good job.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you both. Okay, so we're moving on to the program committee. I will turn it over to our chair of that committee, Director Perez Gill.
At our last board meeting, we went over a couple of funding requests. One has been forwarded to the board for approval. If anybody has questions about anything, feel free to ask.
So we have the information item for the draft minutes, information item for funding requests. Both of them are there in the board documents, and then the grants payment schedule is an information item as well. Are there any questions from any of those three items from any board members? Seeing no, okay, I have Director Zendel who would like to make a question.
When you look at page 67 of the packet, which is part of the program committee, it lists all the current grants that are being worked on. It would be nice, and I know that there is supposed to be something on the website, but it would be nice if maybe once a year we get a report of all the grants that have been given to organizations over the years. So for example, I'd like to know how much money the Joslin Center has gotten from Desert Healthcare District over the last X number of years, or Mizell, or Fine Food Bank, or DAP. It would be good if every once in a while, not every month, but every once in a while, we could have that cumulative report.
You want to do it once a year or twice a year? What do you want, what direction do you want to give staff?
Well, I think there may be a way that it could be put on the website so that it would be present all the time. But at least once a year, I think it's good for us to look back and remind ourselves what we've done and all the different organizations we've supported, not only in the last year, but in the last 70 years.
So a cumulative amount that we've given them. So if we could do that once a year, so make it anniversary. This is July, so the anniversary in July, we would look at it once a year. That at the minimum, maybe more so, but at the request of board members, that at the minimum, every July that we look at that, is that acceptable, Director Zendel?
I would suggest that the staff discuss it and then come back with a recommendation on how often to do it. I don't want to be burdensome, but let the staff heard my request. And I think other people probably would like to know the information too, and they can come up with a recommendation on how best to report it.
Okay, we will leave it up to staff. If you could give us feedback on what you think would be workable for your schedules. Okay, so seeing no other hands raised, I will move on to the next item, an action item, consideration to approve $500,000. To advance the district's role in addressing the healthcare needs of Black communities in the Coachella Valley. And I will turn it over to our CEO.
Thank you, Madam President. I had asked, there is a staff report, which is before you. You can see it on the screen. And I have asked our Chief Program Officer to walk you through this document.
Okay, this was supposed to be presented at the last board meeting, but it was pulled and with the direction for staff to bring it forward to program committee. So we brought this forward to program committee, asking program committee to look at the staff's recommendation of allocating $500,000 from the $1.5 million allocation of bucket number one of addressing healthcare infrastructure and healthcare services as part of the five strategic focus areas that the board approved in June. We were asking the program committee to agree to approve that we allocate out of that $500,000, $400,000 to address access to healthcare. Staff would be looking to develop an RFP for organizations to apply for these funds to see what would be the best way to address healthcare, access to healthcare in Black communities. We would be looking, of course, at the equity and diversion piece, as well as their roles in how they do treat people of color. And then the other $100,000 we're looking to help towards with scholarships for those individuals that would like to pursue a career in healthcare. We'd be working with One Future on that, as they are the experts in this, as well as other foundations that offer scholarships, like I think the other one is the United Negro College Fund. And so we had a pretty good discussion at program committee, and program committee approved moving this money to the foundation of where the initiative would be housed.
Thank you. And
I'm sorry, and then just the next page over on your page 70 is also a map that we pulled of the data of the concentration of Black Americans in the Coachella Valley and where they're located. As Conrado had pointed out at the program committee, Desert Highland Gateway is probably the most isolated as far as for healthcare services. Desert Hot Springs can access Borrego Health Center and their FQHCs up in Desert Hot Springs. Indio has a couple of clinics they can also access. Desert Highland Gateway can go to Desert AIDS Project, but apparently they don't go there because of a perceived stigma of going to DAP.
Thank you, Donna. I will ask if there's any public comments on this item. Andrea?
Yes, so Greg Rodriguez had his hand raised first.
Okay, Greg?
Hey, good evening. Thank you all. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. I think this is an excellent initiative that the healthcare district is undergoing. I just want to give a heads up that Supervisor Perez, in conjunction with Supervisor Washington, will be introducing an ordinance on Tuesday declaring racism a public health crisis. With that being said, too, is we're asking for the formation of a task force within the county structure to look at racism and systematic racism throughout the entire county. As you move forward with this initiative, you know, please, I know you will involve me, but we'd love to partner, obviously, to leverage, hopefully, funds, especially around public health, behavioral health, and the RUHS system, so that we can increase the impact within the 4th District. And then as far as the access to healthcare, especially in the Desert Highland Gateway neighborhood, is actually today the fencing went up for the new RUHS Community Healthcare Center. We are anticipating that to be completed hopefully within 12 to 18 months. That's at the corner of Tuckwitz and Sunrise. So hopefully we'll get rid of that stigma on attending the clinic at the Desert AIDS Project. It's going to be a 35,000 square foot facility with complete integrated behavioral health care, dental services, as well as a pharmacy as well. So we look forward to the county partnering with the Desert Healthcare Center to move this initiative forward. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Greg. Is there any other public comments?
We do. We have Gary Rotto.
Gary Rotto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. Just wanted to echo support that, as Greg had reflected on behalf of Borrego Health, support for this particular item. Donna correctly pointed out in particular at Desert Highland Gateway Community, lack of access to healthcare. We've had some discussions with them over the past couple of months. We're very close to being able to bring testing out there. At least on a special day in August, and then hope to continue that as needed. We have regular days that we will be out in the community providing that type of service, as well as looking at other services that we can help to provide in the community. Again, just wanted to say thank you for moving this document to a board vote, and we are in full support of the proposal.
Thank you, Gary, and thank you, Borrego. Is there any other public comments?
That is no more hands raised.
Okay, very good. Then I will ask the board members if they have any questions. If you could please raise your hand. Director Perez-Gill, do you have any questions?
No, I don't have any questions at this time.
Okay, then I will ask for a motion.
Director Matthews would move approval.
Okay. I second. This is Carol.
Okay, so Director Matthews moves approval of the item. Director Rogers seconds. I will call for the vote. Director.
Wait.
I'm sorry.
You asked for questions.
You quickly.
You asked okay. for questions, but I have a comment.
Okay, yes. Comment from Director Zendel.
Yes. I fully support this. I think $500,000 is a good start. I think I hope we can actually provide more money in the future. I understand the reasoning behind, first of all, I support the allocation being going toward both access for healthcare and expanding racial diversity of the healthcare workforce. I'm not sure the $400,000, $100,000 split is that big a deal, but on the other hand, I guess you have to start somewhere. I hope that it can be flexible so that if a lot of grant requests come in for health professional workforce and not as much for primary care. You can move that around. I think what you're hearing for the board is we want to allocate $500,000 for this effort, and that the areas of access and workforce diversity are important. But I'm personally not tied to the $400,000, $100,000 split, and I hope you'll be flexible.
So there's a circle going around recommended response. And is that our CEO who made that circle? No? Is that Andrea? You're on mute.
I'm sorry. I was just bringing that area of attention since Director Zindel brought it forward. But Director Matthews also has a comment.
Okay. No, I was making the motion. Sorry. That was my comment.
Okay. Is there any other comments or question from any board members on this item before we call for the vote?
I'll say a quick comment to this. I'm glad it was brought to the program committee. We were able to like flush out a lot of questions that we like felt we needed to ask. One of them being, will organizations outside of Highland Gateway Estates be able to apply? And the answer was like, yes, so long as they can, you know, perform their audits, share it with us, go through the LOI process and our grant process. I know that there's quite a few Black-led, Black-serving nonprofits in Desert Hot Springs. There's one in Palm Desert that serves the whole span of the Coachella Valley. And there's others. There's one in particular from Moreno Valley that comes into the Coachella Valley and provides support for families in DHS and in Palm Springs. So we did have like a very good conversation around this. We appreciate having the ability to have this conversation in the program committee to flesh out some of the questions. And same thing, same similar comments as Director Zindel. Fully support this. I think it's also a really great start, and hoping to see if anybody comes out of the woodworks to match some of this, right?
Thank you, Vice President Borg. I appreciate your comments. Is there any other board member who would like to make a comment or has a question at this point? Okay. Very good. Thank you, staff, for bringing that forward. And I will call for the vote. Director Shore. Is that a yes? Are you a support of the motion?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. It's okay. Director Zindel.
Yes.
Director Perez-Gill.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Vice President Borja.
Yes.
And I vote yes, so it passes unanimously. And I just want to thank staff for bringing this forward originally and for taking the time to provide the additional information to all of us. Looking forward to moving forward on this.
Thank you so much.
The next information item is, I'll turn it over to Donna, Long-Term Comprehensive Strategies to Advancing, or is this Conrado?
Yes, that's me. And this actually speaks to the last point that was made by some of the board members. Hopefully, yes, there will be others that will be contributing to this effort. We understand that this is a first step. We understand that the healthcare needs of communities of color in the Desert Healthcare District are many, and that one time is not the answer, it's just the beginning. We understand that looking to the future to have a sustainable long-term solution to access to healthcare that these communities are facing with, will require the contributions of the city, of the county, of other nonprofit organizations, of other foundations, and also the contributions of the business community that are benefiting from community members that live in these communities, that they come and they establish their warehouses, they establish their industries, and we want them to have the opportunity to make a fair contribution to the well-being of the members of our community by contributing to their well-being, to their employment, to their economic opportunities, and also to their access to healthcare and other wellness benefits. That's Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any board member comments or question on this item? Yeah, I don't see any hands. Director Perez-Gill, do you have any questions or comments?
No, thank you.
Okay, and Conrado, I see your hand go back up.
Madam President, if you allow me, I would like to add that we had a site visit of the Noble Ranch community and the Desert Highland Gateway community with IEHP. This was part of this effort of inviting others to learn about what the district is doing and also to invite them to contribute to bringing to the needs of those communities.
Thank you, and I appreciate their interest in taking the time to go out and take that site visit. So look forward to hearing more about how that could develop into a future partnership.
Thanks.
The next item on the agenda is the Finance, Legal Administration, and Real Estate Committee. And I will turn it over to the chair of that committee, Director Matthews.
All you really have are the minutes from our July 14th meeting. And if there's any questions, we could answer them. But other than that, it's just the minutes. There's no action to be taken other than to approve the minutes, which we will do at the meeting. But
okay. Very good. Thank you. Is there any questions or comments from any of the board members on this item? Seeing no hands, then I will move on to the next item, the Strategic Planning Committee. And Director Zendel, do you have anything you want to share on one of the two items, the minutes and probably the community needs assessment? It's a little bit more detailed. So I'll let you start it, and then maybe we turn it over to our CEO.
Okay. Basically, we talked about at the meeting, we talked about the supporting the healthcare efforts in the Black community, and then we had an update on what's going on with the community needs assessment and the delay that is being caused by COVID-19 and the inability to conduct some of the community outreach that was planned for. And that was really all we talked about at the meeting. We did mention that we need to have contingencies. If it gets delayed any longer, we're going to have to figure out we may have to extend our interim strategic planning, which was supposed to last only a year. But Conrado, did you want to add anything to that?
Yes, I want to add that the staff put together a written report on the update on the community health needs assessment. And I want to highlight that we have some challenges as we're trying to implement this project. It is a very ambitious project, no question about it. And the timeline was tied to begin with, and then the pandemic hit us and has made everything even more complicated. The challenges of reaching out to the communities and having community meetings to listen to our community and gather all that input is something that has become very difficult under the current circumstances. But also there is an issue of accessing data sets that are specific to the Coachella Valley so that we can have a better assessment, a better understanding of where the needs are and how we can plan for the future to create a robust infrastructure that is responsive to very specific and measurable needs that we have in our district. So that report is on page 76 and 77 of the board packet.
Thank you. I do have, first of all, ask, is there any board members' comments or questions about the community health needs assessment and health improvement plan update? I see no hands. On page 77 of the report, there's a reference to the Community Advisory Council. who is on there, or is that already in place, or are you still in the process of recruiting, or what is the Community Advisory Council?
It is already in place. The HARC put together a list of community members that they wanted to invite, and they have been reaching out to those community members. Staff has helped HARC to reach out to some of those. And for things that I can remember, we invited Dieter Crawford to represent Desert Highland Gateway. We also contacted some of the school board members, the superintendent of schools at Coachella Valley Unified School District, and some of those individuals that were not responding to HARC, and we helped them with that outreach.
So are those meetings going forward now, or is it going to wait until the delayed process resumes?
Our plan is to start doing a combination of Zoom meetings and probably combine that with some Facebook Live events. Having a convenings of the community committee is not that complicated, because we're talking about individuals that have access to technology, that having a computer and Zoom meeting is not that challenging. But when it comes to the outreach to the community members, when we want to gather the input from the end users, if you will, of the consumers, of the people that have the day-to-day challenges of finding a doctor, getting their kids into a dental clinic, and getting their immunizations, and if they have an emergency, where do they go? That is what it's proving to be more challenging, because some of those community members don't have even Wi-Fi at home. They rely on a cell phone. Sometimes our plans that are restricted in the number of data that they can use on their phones, and then the size of the screen is not the most useful device to read a data heavy document that they will need to digest and comment on those. So those are some of the challenges we're facing.
What caught my attention was the fact that what you just described, that it is very difficult to interface with consumers because there's no relationship usually with the consumers. But with the Community Advisory Council, that you do have relationships with a lot of these groups or representatives, that maybe that's something that that could be initiated prior to, even despite the problems that we've had with that COVID has created. But I was just caught by that, and I just thank you. I appreciate the explanation. Is there any other board member that has any questions or comments? And I see a hand. Director Zendel.
I just wanted to add, because I went to one of the advisory committee council meetings, UCR School of Medicine is represented, County Health is represented. I mean, it really is an advisory council, and I presume HARC is being continuing contact with them, but it's a very good advisory council.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it, that it's going on. That's what I was curious about. Appreciate it. Thank you. Any other questions or comments from any board members? I have Donna.
Actually, we have two. We have a steering committee and advisory committee. The steering committee is what Les was referring to with UCR. Those are the ones that are providing a lot of the data that we need, the data sets. And then the advisory is just what it is basically advisory.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it. Okay, so we'll move on to the next item, which is old business, the 2020 census Coachella Valley update. I'll turn it over, this information item, to our CEO.
Thank you. And we have asked Megan Kenny to provide a brief update on that. Is Megan?
Megan's on vacation.
Oh.
She timed that well, didn't she?
Donna, can you speak about it?
Yeah, I'll try. Actually, what she has, she's been tracking the census numbers, and that what she really wanted to point out is the Coachella Valley is still very much behind Western by County in the self-response rate, and you can see what she's compared from national national, the state, and then the county, and then broke out the different cities by zip code where their percentage falls. So she's been doing a good job tracking that, and I think she participates with Alianza and what they're doing with, and also with Karthik in the Inland Empire. So if you have any questions, I'll try and answer them. If I can't, I'll write them down and ask Megan when she comes back.
Okay, so I will first turn it over to our board members. Do you have any questions or comments?
I have a comment, especially in this environment with COVID, I'm becoming increasingly concerned about the census and an undercount. And I don't know whether we can be of any help that way through our community involvement. But I'm very concerned that, especially where there's disparities, we're going to have a lot of undercounting, and that concerns me.
Yes, I agree with you completely. The non-response rate is very low in many communities, and the next step of strategy is August 11th. I'm wondering if we have a supporting role on that. Conrado, are we supporting any organization? You mentioned Alianza. So are we supporting Alianza and help in trying to get the response rate higher?
So we're not providing financial support to any organization. What we have been doing is posting on our Facebook and our social media and also on our website, and trying to be as aware as we can of the needs in our community. I wish we had a specific item or an action item that we could say, this is something that we can do. I haven't found what role specific the district can play in inviting community members to complete the census.
And it's the same problem that we're having with the community health needs assessment, the community engagement. It's keeping people, well, self-response is different, but even still, they haven't gone out door to door yet.
Yeah. Board member comments or questions?
Yes. One comment. We have, the census has been up and running since the middle of March, I believe March 12th. So those people who are like comfortable navigating the internet have already completed their census, right? So if any of you know anyone who has not, it might behoove you to either lend them some support, some technical support, or provide them with the U.S. Census Bureau phone number where they can just call and complete the census on their own time on the phone. But Mark Matthews is 100% correct. Some of the COVID CARES money that has come down to our communities has come down through the census count. Some of those numbers are very old. They're 10 years old now. Whatever funding comes to us in the next couple of years will also be distributed through census numbers. We know that our communities have grown tremendously. My city, the city of Indio, at the last state of the city said that since the last census, the city has grown approximately 15 to 20,000 people. That's quite a bit of people, right? And if those folks are not counted, we will not receive the post-COVID support that we need to make sure that our communities are safe and back to some kind of stability.
I appreciate that Vice President Borja brought this item up at the last meeting, and the efforts that staff has taken to present this information. I want to also communicate the message from Director Rogers. She asked the question, can the district offer an incentive to complete the census? Possibly a $5 gift card. Amrado.
I believe that's a policy decision, if that's the direction that the board wants to give the staff. Happy to implement it.
This is an information item today. I don't know if we could actually change it to be an action item, probably until the next meeting. Right,
yes.
Okay, so if
then we also have public comments too, whenever you're ready.
Okay, so maybe that's something that staff could consider there as are there high high non-response areas? I know we see the information before us, but would there be a strategy on how that could be implemented and who would do it? I don't know if it would be Alianza or but we could discuss that and bring it back as an item maybe for consideration. But before we move forward, I want to open it up for comments and further board comments so that we have a consensus, if not a vote, at least consensus. So Andrea, who are the speakers on this?
It's Greg Rodriguez.
Okay, Greg?
First of all, I would at least look into the legality of incentives on the count, just to give you a heads up on that. Additionally, I wanted to note is that, you know, we've been watching this not only out of our office, but our county efforts in conjunction with Alianza and Karthik and the team in the west part of the county on these numbers. And so, as everyone has said on here, COVID has made this a very difficult thing to accomplish. But with that being said, is there had been somewhat of a hiring freeze on census workers that is being lifted, and so people are being onboarded. Additionally, we are looking at some alternative ways to collect data through, especially for those that are digitally challenged, through clinics, through our FQHCs, through farm workers, you know, on their daily calls. And so just to let the district know is that the county, and especially under the direction of Saida out of our office for Supervisor Perez, are looking on how we really ramp up these efforts going forward.
So is there any other comments, Andrea, from the public?
No, there are not.
Okay. Any other board member comments? I see Director Zendel's hand up. Director Zendel?
Yeah, there are a lot of organizations out there that are helping promote the census. And I think rather than us coming up with a method of our own, we might want to contact one or two of them to discuss whether or not they think we could be of any help. Mm-hmm. I know that we, if I remember correctly, at one of our meetings, and it was at the Cathedral City Senior Center, we did have a community member get up and talk about the census, and he was actually one of the district people. Actually, I'm sorry, it wasn't at a district meeting, a healthcare district meeting, it was another meeting. But there are nonprofits out there that are promoting the census, and we might want to contact them rather than try to add to our own responsibilities.
Very good. Conrado, you had your hand up?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I do think that Greg makes up made a good point, and also collaborated by our Director Zendel, in that there are people that are working on this. Supervisor Perez's office, the lead person being Zaida, as he identified her, and then Karthik from UCR, CSI, and also Alianza. So I think those are people that Conrado already knows probably and can follow up with to coordinate, not to duplicate or compete with, but to coordinate and to collaborate with. So if you could come back with us on in the next meeting to tell us if there's a way that we could support their efforts.
Yes, wonderful, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so the next item is consideration to approve, okay. This one, I will be turning it over to our Vice President, Borja, and just let me know when you are done talking about item J3, okay?
Leticia? Conrado, do you want to talk about the book? I think she might have missed page 8.
Yes, and we asked Will to provide a brief update on the book. There is actually a document in the board packet. It's on page 80. It has a brief background on what's happening with the district and foundation history book project. So as you know, we have an author that we hire. Will, do you want to provide a brief update?
Yes, hi, I'm here. Yeah, just to recap what's in the staff report, our writer submitted a first draft in June, and I, with the help of the staff, had put together a review committee, which is comprised of Director Matthews, three former directors, and members of the staff. The review committee submitted feedback and suggestions, which I shared with the writer along with my own. He is now revising the draft and identifying photos, and we expect to have another draft in mid-August. The main difference with this project from before is that we have decided to push the publication date forward into early 2021. And again, it comes back to COVID. Well, mainly two reasons. One is that during the research, the writer found a lot of material, as you would imagine, for a 70 plus year old district. And so the book is actually longer than we anticipated. And the other reason is that we, from the beginning, wanted to have an event around the release of the book. And that's pretty impossible to do during a pandemic. And so we want to push that to early 2021, hoping that we'll have some semblance of normalcy again. And so we look forward to doing that. And I think that's pretty much it. Everything is right there in the staff report. I'm open to questions.
Does anyone have any questions for Will? No. Okay.
I got one quick comment. Will, I thank you very much. I know I owe you some information. And I think moving it back, all of us in our personal and professional lives have been affected pretty deeply with what's going on with COVID. And I think pushing it into next year is an excellent idea.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to move us forward to the next item, which is grant number 1080, Lift to Rise. Conrado, could you lead us in that conversation, please?
Yes. There is a report on page 81 and 82 of the board packet and a letter that we received from Lift to Rise. With the budget modification, we awarded Lift to Rise with a $100,000 grant to provide cash assistance, and then we expanded that to offer $400,000 to support rental assistance. Lift to Rise has done a tremendous job at leveraging district funding with other foundations, and actually the county has provided. A significant amount of money to provide support on the rental assistance project. One of the challenges that Lift to Rise is facing is that with the increased amount of funding, well, there is an increased amount of work and an increased number of applicants that are trying to benefit from this project. The challenge with that is that operational cost was typically not included in any of the grants, or the amount that was approved, which was basically 5%, is insufficient to provide all the support that is needed for this. Therefore, they submitted a request to modify the grant dollars. That's the request that is before you. And also we invited Lift to Rise to be on this meeting, and I'm sure you will have some questions, and Lift to Rise is available to answer those questions. They have their CEO, Heather Bicona. They also have one of their program managers and their finance person, Matthew, who's on the call as well.
I would just like to clarify for the public, Director Velara stepped out because she does sit on the Lift to Rise's board. Hello, Lift to Rise staff. I would like to invite you to our meeting and to share any comments that you may want to share with us tonight.
Hi, thank you, Vice President Borja. We have myself, Heather Otticelli, are you on? Mm-hmm. Otticelli Palafox, our Deputy Director, And our external financial controller, Matt Gonda, is also, are we echoing? Sorry, we're in the same room, but we're socially distanced. One second. I just mean, are you good? Still echoing. Okay, sorry about that. Yes, so we have Araceli and Matt on the phone. I just wanted to say a couple of things from the top that I think might have created confusion with the way that we submitted the modification. So we modified the initial budget that we had submitted to you. We did not create an entirely new budget that shows, as Conrado mentioned, the gap or the deficit in operational costs that we're experiencing. So I recognize that it's probably confusing looking at the first budget and not being able to see the actual gap in what we're facing. So a couple of things that I'll just say really quickly, and then I think if we could let Matt, our financial controller, speak to the operational cost issue, and then maybe Araceli speak a little bit to the programmatic issue. So the County of Riverside, I think folks know on the phone, made the third largest allocation in the country per capita for rental assistance. Prior to this allocation, we had raised $2 million in commitments to rental assistance. The scaling that we had to do as an organization sort of overnight to step up and be able to implement this program was massive. We more than doubled our staff size. But also, to be fair to all parties involved, we weren't really exactly sure of exactly what it would cost to run this program. And we also, one thing that I think is really key to point out is that we were holding a hypothesis together with funders, including the county, that it was going to cost about $3,500 per household to make households whole on their rent. So on our side of the county and in the Coachella Valley specifically, it's only costing $2,100 per household to make a household whole. So what happens there is that we're actually able to reach more households and disperse more funding, but that doubles our workload nearly without an additional pool of resource to be able to do that, work. Also, this is incredibly labor intensive work. We've shared with Conrado and some other folks that are on the call, we're averaging one message per minute from a resident. And this isn't just transactional work of we receive an application, we verify with a resident. The thousands and thousands of folks that are both applying and receiving assistance, each household is experiencing a deep moment of, at best, insecurity, at worst, deep trauma. And so the volume of support that is needed has really, really put pressure on us as an organization and as staff to step up to that. So I wanted to just offer from the top that I can see where the budget might be confusing, because what we did is took the initial budget that we submitted to you and said this is what we would actually be in the best position to use these resources for. But I could pass it over to Matt and Araceli to specifically talk through some of the questions that were posed to us earlier. But one last point I'll make is that this last pay period, we expected to disperse payments to to 500 households. We estimate disbursing payments in this first pay period to 1,300 households. So that's not just like all of a sudden automatically disbursing an additional 800 checks. That's working with 800 more households. That's verifying with landlords and residents. It's a lot more work. And I think the other thing just to really underscore is that we have to be highly adaptive. So the first month, the challenge was, how do we get to more households? What we're finding this month, and I think just to piggyback on your conversation about the census, this month, as we start to clean the data, we're recognizing a very large population of folks who are unable to complete the application because they do not have the technological tools to do it. So we're gonna have to make a full court sprint in the first 2 weeks of August to really pivot on how we do mobile outreach and support so that those hard to reach folks are able to submit their applications. So we absorbed all of our costs when we did the economic protection plan. And as we continue to implement this large program, we need to make sure that we have the backbone resource to very quickly get to households. And I think everyone on the phone knows that the CARES Act funding is pumpkin money. We have to get it out and into folks' hands and households funded by December. So I'll pause. I know that was a lot of information if there's questions, but we had some specific questions that were posed to us and Matt can answer them if that would be helpful.
Yes, go ahead, Matt.
Hi, everybody. I want to start by echoing what Heather is saying is that it's something new for all of us. So we, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm the external accountant to the organization. This was something that was posed early on in June. So we're not even quite 2 months into it. And we are learning quite a bit through this whole process about the costs that go into it, how to run the program, how everything is really going to look. And like Heather said, our expenses are going to go up, both one, because we're finding new things we have to spend on in outreach and in staffing, but also just with the number of households that we're going to serve, there's a lot more out there. The first question that I wanted to address was what the money that we're asking for would cover. And based on what we provided, and again, I want to reiterate, the budget that we provided, that we presented for the original grant request was kind of on first blush information. So we've come a long ways since then, and I'm trying to put this all in the perspective of that application. On the application, we were at about $270,000 of staffing costs. So that's for everything from resource coordinators to the folks that are helping to payment process the payments, everybody who's directly involved in that. That there's not a whole lot in there that's not specifically related to this program where the expenses wouldn't really exist outside of it. On top of the $270,000 for the staffing cost, we've got a lot in tech support, or the tech platform that we use to run the program, in communication support, data mapping, payment processing. There's a lot in there that we get covered, and it's all 100% direct cost for the program that we're spending in order to get the money out the door to the residents. So that leaves for the next question about where our source of funds is really coming from. And the county, in starting this up, provided the funding and then gave us a 5% administrative fee to draw against. And what we're finding is it's an amazing program. It's an amazing, like Heather said, it's one of the largest per capita rental assistance programs out there. It's just something like this has never existed before. So that 5% is going to come in at over $500,000, but we expect that the total cost to run this program is going to be somewhere around $1 million to $1.1 million in total costs after we factor in everything that, you know, frankly, we didn't put into the original budget and that we probably wouldn't have ever known until a month in or 6 weeks into this program. So the way that breaks down for us is we expect to get about $500,000 to $520,000 from the county in terms of the fee that they've provided to us for the direct program delivery cost. We're also going to have money from another grant that's coming in, but that probably won't come in until the very end of the program. So it's not something we can rely on for funding up front. And then there's another about $100,000 that we've got sourced from another organization. So all in, we need another $400,000 to really be able to deliver the program at in a high caliber way, and in a way that is efficient and that can get the money out to the residents as quickly as possible. And then, actually, I think that answers most of the questions. I kind of want to reiterate one thing is, if we hit the $1.1 million in expenses against all of the rental assistance direct payments we make, we're going to be right around 8% of that cost. So for every dollar that goes out to a resident in rent assistance, we're spending about 8 cents, which is, frankly, I think a pretty amazing dollar amount that we're spending and that we're keeping it so low. And in my line of work, usually if you're under 10%, that's a really good place to be. So between what the CARES Act money is coming in from Riverside County, CDBG money that's coming in towards the end, we're in a really good position to help the community, to help the residents, but it does cost a lot of money.
I'm going to ask the board if there's any clarifying questions that anyone needs to ask of Matt. Go ahead, Liz.
Well, I don't know if this is for Matt, but I don't remember the board seeing an original contract that we approved. Did we approve an original contract? Conrado?
The answer is yes.
With a budget and everything, a contract?
Yes.
Well, I've looked through the minutes and I can't find it. So maybe I'm mistaken, but I don't remember seeing a contract.
And Toronto, I believe, wasn't it approved in May? It was approved, or April, it was approved early on, the economic protection plan.
I believe
about the extra $400,000.
It was an amendment to the original contract that was approved in, I believe it was March, March or April. And then we had an amendment to that contract, increasing the amount for another 400,000. And that was approved a couple meetings ago.
Okay, so I just want to clarify. We had a contract for $100,000, which we approved, and then we approved an additional 400,000. Okay, thank you.
Donna?
It was an extra 500,000.
Yes, for the total of 600,000.
It was a cost grant extension of 500,000 for a total of 600,000.
Matt, I have a question regarding the second sentence on page 83. Second paragraph, second sentence of page 83 of our packet. It says the cost of implementing the program significantly exceeds the 5% administration fee provided by the County CARES Act. 5% of 13 million is 650,000. I think you just said that the county is giving you 500,000. So could you clarify which of those are?
So the contracted amount for the county is in total about 10.3 million for CARES Act funding in specific, of which our portion is roughly 520,000. There's an additional CDBG grant that we anticipate receiving another 1.5 million on that would provide us another 75,000 in admin fees towards the end of this. My understanding at least is that money comes in a little bit later in this process. So that gets us to right around 600,000 in admin fees.
Karen, this is Heather. I'll just jump in really quick. So the way that the county contracts, and Greg and Mike Walsh are also on the phone, are allocated is that the Board of Supervisors approved $30 million in CARES Act funding, an additional $3.5 million in CDBG funding. So our allocation portion is 35% of that. So it's 13.5 million. There's three things to point out that we haven't pointed out yet. One is the disbursement of funds. So we didn't receive a lump sum of the CARES. We receive payments monthly. And we did receive, I think Matt might be able to say the first month, I think it was almost $3 million. And then again, we're allowed to draw 5% against that. That was to cover the first 2 months of disbursement. The county was incredibly generous in allowing for all eligible households in the first round to be funded. But what that did to us in terms of our planning is, and I don't know if folks are familiar or have seen the plan we have for implementation. We expect, we're all holding a hypothesis together, that August, September, and October are going to be the most dire months for residents, as a lot of public benefits, as we're seeing just this week, are drying up. So we had planned for, staffed for, making an allocation of 500 payments, kind of overnight from a Friday to a Monday. we went to needing to make 1,300 payments. So what that does in terms of just being able to pivot, absorb the costs, figure it out, and also we're making commitments, long-term commitments, to run the program for the duration of the program without all the resources in hand. And I think just another point to make is that all of you were so incredibly catalytic in the first part of the fund we raised with the emergency protection plan, the economic protection plan. You and the RAP Foundation and the United Way were the first folks to put money up. And I don't know what we multiplied that times. I think it was 10 at least, or maybe 12. And so we have this vehicle. We almost daily get calls from funders and other municipalities who would like to contribute. And then we're constantly in this question of, can we do it? Can we take on these other resources and take on the challenges that we're facing because we absorbed all of our costs in the first part of this work? So really all we're trying to do is to ask to be able to use these resources in a way that allows us to continue to really leverage and aggregate and multiply. This is beyond our wildest conception of what we would be able to distribute to the community.
Thank you. Any other questions for Matt or Heather at this point? I know that there's one more person on their staff, Araceli, who also wants to speak to us tonight.
Yeah, so I'll
and I will go into public comments in a second.
Sure.
Araceli, are you ready?
Microphone, if that's okay.
Can you hear me?
A little louder.
Oh, okay, I'll just move. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, we're in the same room. And
we can't hear you.
Oh, sorry, she's back.
Okay, can you hear me okay?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. So I just wanted to speak a little bit on the topic of what our kind of day-to-day operations look like and what roles we've all had to take on to be able to implement and support this program. And I first want to start by saying that we have an incredible team of staff that were already permanent staff who shifted most of their time on this, but we've also brought up a good chunk of folks to support this program, and we've all taken on a variety of roles to be able to do so. And so on the top, I think there was a question on kind of what the operations look like, what our interactions are with residents and the landlords as we implement and really work through processing payments. And so I wanted to speak a little bit on that. And so what that really encompasses is working with landlords to verify the rental details and the tenant details. So there's work that's happening at the same time along two kind of both parties, right? There's work that we do with the tenant, and then there's work that we do with the landlords to really collect the necessary and required documentations to be able to process the application. In many cases, however, we've found that it is sometimes hard for the tenant to be able to collect some of the required documentation. So we've shifted to working really heavily with landlords so that documentation does not pose an additional barrier for residents to be able to access this resource. So to give you an example, a lot of folks don't have a copy of their lease agreement on hand. And even though that's a required document with the county, they've been able to be flexible with us in places where we've proposed and recommended alternative forms to be able to satisfy that requirement. So we designed a landlord certification form that essentially works in the same way to verify some of those rent terms. So I give you that example just to paint a picture of kind of the work that we do holding both parties together to be able to make sure that the tenant gets through the process, and so that we can minimize the effect that some of the barriers in terms of documentation that folks face. And then additionally, we know that there are barriers to just access, right? Getting the documentations and taking pictures or scanning and uploading. So we've explored what does it really mean to support residents through this? And so whether that's a Dropbox option or having folks on the phone, walking them through how you take a picture, use your phone to upload it, and really trying to challenge ourselves to lean into the places where we could do better so that this program does not exclude some of the communities that face those barriers. And so the function of our coordinators and our team who are implementing this program every day is not just about the application process, it's not just about how do we collect the documents that we need, but it's really about supporting folks through this process and helping them connect to the immediate relief that they need. And we are incredibly grateful to get to administer this program on the county's behalf, because then we also have the opportunity to recognize where we might make recommendations that apply to other types of programs that could inform and increase access along these programs. So I wanted to offer that just to speak a little bit about, to give you a picture of the work that we're doing every day as we work our way to process payments and now take on the July application period. Thank you.
Any questions for Araceli from the board? I have a question. Having worked in the Eastern Coachella Valley with some community members who live in incredibly broken down households that they've rented out, what if a landlord has not given a tenant their, for example, lease agreement? What if some of these things that people cannot find on their end is because the landlord has not provided those things to the tenant? What if the housing is substandard, which I personally know that a lot of it in the Eastern Coachella Valley does fall into that category, not all of it, but there's quite a bit of substandard housing. Does the landlord still get that payment? Does the county do a follow-up conversation situation? Do tenants get support with like legal aid or something else to have conversations with tenants or with landlords about like fixing some of this substandard housing? I know that when you first spoke to us last year, that was definitely one of the conversations that you brought up, right? Just the amount, the massive amount of substandard housing. So when I saw your proposal and I read like the landlord lines, I said, oh, this is like a landlord program, right? This is money that is going straight to the landlord, not actually the tenant. So it's not a renter program, it's a landlord program. So I was just, you know, my history and my relationships in the East Valley asked me to ask some of these, led me to ask some of these questions about this part of the program.
You want me to start?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll start and then Araceli will jump in. So just two things to say really quickly, Vice President Borja. One is that that's part of the role of tenant of resource coordinators and landlord coordinators, is that we push and we work with residents to make sure that we can get everything that we can from their landlords. I understand what you're saying, that it sounds like it's a tenant program and not a renters program. We work directly with renters. The renters are the folks that we're working with, and then we work to liaise with them, with their landlords. The big bulk of the funding that's prescribed requires that the funding is paid to landlords directly, but we make sure that we're centering tenants and supporting them. We also budgeted for and have been, we haven't landed one specific fair housing lawyer to work with us for the duration of the time. But Lift Rise holds an external legal team that's worked with us on two other projects. And your question about what do we do in the case of if there's substandard housing, is there a way to refer folks to external legal aid, or is there a way that we can work on either reducing rent or reducing the amount that's paid to the landlord? These are questions that we're holding and trying to answer while simultaneously making sure that folks don't get evicted from their home. Because the bottom line is, and unfortunately, I know that folks are in such a precarious position. We are really like goal number one is keeping folks in their homes right now. So that question, there's definitely a gap, and we're trying to incorporate a more robust legal aid component. But really right now, what we're finding is our biggest challenge is overcoming, we're disbursing thousands of payments and simultaneously trying to overcome any functional barriers that the communities that you're talking about have in actually being able to get the assistance, because they have to submit documents, they have to get photocopies, and the coordination of that. So that's where our focus has been. But Araceli, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, well, I think Heather really summed it up, but the only other thing that I'll...
We can't hear Araceli anymore.
Please recognize...
Oh, she can hear you. Wait, can you hear her? No.
Get up to the mic.
Our fault that we're in the same room.
Okay, can you can hear me okay now?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I think I was saying that I think Heather did a good job at summarizing, but the only additional thing that I'll offer is that we absolutely recognize the more kind of informal rental arrangements that exist. We recognize kind of all of those factors that contribute to one's overall housing circumstances. And so in terms of like trying to work with the tenants and the landlords to make sure that if there isn't a formal lease agreement that doesn't immediately disqualify them, we're absolutely doing that. My example earlier in terms of the like required lease agreement, we found a way to be able to supply, satisfy that requirement with an alternative form. And so our team every day, if you go into our workspace that we hold, we're notating every single scenario that we encounter. What are residents telling us about the barriers that they're facing and getting a proof of their back or past due rent? What are all of the things so that we can lift those things up, pick up on those patterns, and create a better implementation process throughout the application process? And so on a weekly basis, we're bringing these recommendations to the county. And thus far, they've been really always listening to what's happening on the ground and how might we solve for it. The second thing that I wanted to speak a little bit on is the substandard housing conditions or the other issues that we might encounter. There is a portion on the application that was intended and built into the application so that we can capture some data about what is happening, what are the issues that residents are facing in terms of whether it's a fair housing question, whether it's a substandard living situation and the price for what you're paying and the unit is not matching up. There is a very small section in the application that's allowing us to capture what those things are so that we can have that inform what a legal component might look like for a rental assistance program, but also for the kind of ongoing legal questions that folks have along the areas of housing. So I just wanted to add those two additional things.
Thank you. I appreciate all of the answers to my questions. I didn't realize how many restrictions the county had added on you and on this program. So I appreciate all of your flexibility. Definitely a lot of informal housing situations everywhere, really. Thank you. Any other questions from the board to the Lift to Rise team?
Yeah, I just have one question, Director Matthews here. I just heard this, that Governor Newsom said landlords couldn't throw people out till the end of till December 31st. Now, I think if there's a method to get people paid, that's a good thing and a better idea as well. But am I mistaken on that? Is that something that's going on now? In California, you can't evict a housing tenant?
That's correct.
The eviction moratorium, yes.
That's my understanding.
Are there any public comments?
We do. Greg Rodriguez has his hand raised.
Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, thank you, Vice President Borja. I want to approach this from the county aspect and first address a couple things that just came up on as far as some of the restrictions that have been placed upon whether it's Lift to Rise or United Way of Inland Valley. Those are CARES Act restrictions, not necessarily county restrictions. And as Araceli mentioned, we have bent over backwards to make sure that we've implemented this with the least restrictions as possible and to get the money out the door as fast as possible. It is true that the eviction moratorium is in place by the governor really until the lifting of the emergency order. Some people have issues with how that applies, but technically the courts are not allowed to evict anybody at this time. We are also working daily referring people to Inland Legal and other organizations to provide advice on evictions. And then additionally, and I know Heather said Mike is on the phone, is we have conversations weekly, not multiple times weekly, on substandard conditions. And this has been an issue before COVID hit, and will continue to be an issue that we face as a county and will address. I just want to back up a little bit. And as many of you know, is the supervisor tried to get an eviction moratorium from the county level, and that was not successful due to the lack of support from other supervisors. And so we worked to address the issue by the allocation of the $33 million for a rental assistance program. As it's already been mentioned, we are one of the largest per capita in the country instituting this program. The county chose Lift to Rise and United Way of the Inland Valley because they had already had the infrastructure built in. As Heather has communicated to the district, and as the district knows, and has generously funded the economic protection plan, the original rental assistance. And as it's also been mentioned, and as I've mentioned on calls before, is that Lift to Rise had covered the administrative costs of the the economic protection plan going forward. What we have noticed, and what's been referenced by others on the call, is that the demand has far exceeded the expectations we anticipated. You know, from going from 500 anticipated payments to over 1,300. And as Heather mentioned, and I can attest to, and as we see on a national level, this is only going to get worse. As we see reductions in unemployment compensation, certain members of Congress and the White House claiming that, you know, these are incentives for people to stay home. These are not incentives for people to stay home. These are jobs that have not come back. And we know that more than any other area of the country in the Coachella Valley. The 5% administration fee usually is a standard, but it has proven not to be sufficient in implementing this program. And, as Matt had said, is that, you know, anything below 10% is a good number. And to Heather's point and Araceli's point, this is not just about typical administration of a grant program. This is really counseling. It's, you know, listening to people's problems. It's and you know, we deal with this in our office on a daily basis, and I can only imagine the level of communication and really behavioral health treatment and really developing a housing plan for these individuals has really proved to be a burden. Now, we are looking at the county on how we could help increase those administrative costs. We're bound by certain restrictions on the CARES Act. But with that being said, with the partnership that the Desert Healthcare District has already committed to, the reallocation of these two admin costs really allows the county, Lift to Rise, United Way of Inland Valley, to distribute more actual dollars on the ground to really impact the daily lives of the renters that we're trying to assist. I really want to highlight too on, Araceli mentioned this, and Heather to some degree, is the data portion of this. If any of you have seen the data report that was released last week, the amount of data that we're getting and the incredible depth of that data is only going to help us and help the district in analyzing what the needs are when it comes to housing security and social determinants of health. And these admin dollars really help assist in us analyzing that data. I'll close, and again, I'm happy to answer any questions on behalf of the county portion of this, but I also want to mention that many of you may have seen the article in the Desert Sun about the racist activity that Lift to Rise and their team members have had to experience over this. It's a shame, and I get chills. It brings me to tears that we are literally trying to keep people from falling into homelessness. We are literally trying to keep families above the water in this pandemic, just in rental assistance alone, let alone the great work that the district and in partnership with the county and other organizations have done for providing food. But when their staff is not only helping three times more than the anticipated people that we thought they were gonna have to help, are having to deal with the racist comments and the racist calls and the death threats that they've had, is it's just incomprehensible. And so I would really encourage the district to allow Lift to Rise to redirect this, because again, it really is gonna get more money into the pockets of people to pay their rent and stay in their homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Any other public comments?
I see none.
Donna?
I just had two questions. Is CB HIP pretty active in helping with a lot of the referrals and the references and resources, and also the other organizations? Because Greg had mentioned that it's just not handing out money, but you're also doing a lot of counseling. Are you working with other nonprofit organizations like Jewish Family Service of the Desert and the LGBT Center and all those other organizations that actually do a lot of mental health counseling and other kinds of counseling and help them get resources besides just money for housing?
Sure, I'll answer quickly because I'm not sure how Araceli and my microphones are working right now. Yeah, so Araceli has been working with Alejandro on looping, and we have a profile on CB HIP, not CB Link. so we have a profile on CB HIP, and Araceli has been working with Alejandro. And the second part of the question was about working with community orgs. Was that right, Donna?
Yeah.
Yes. So, in fact, in some of the way that we budgeted for outreach, we have absorbed the cost of some partner organizations like COFEM, who are supporting the work both in outreach and supporting with residents. We are liaising with as many partners as possible, especially on the outreach piece. And then the behavioral health question, was that for our tenants or for our staff? Sorry.
I guess it could be for both.
we're not, for behavioral health support for tenants yet. We do have behavioral health support in the office for staff.
That's good. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the board?
I want to make a comment, but I want to hear the motion, and I want to have everybody else to make a comment too.
Do I hear a motion on the floor?
I move that we accept the proposal.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Arthur. Thank you, Carol. Go ahead, Les.
So I'm a little both confused and unhappy with this proposal. I remember in April we were asked to give $100,000 for rental assistance, and we did that amongst a lot of other things in relation to COVID. And then in June, we were asked to give another $500,000. And I had questions at the time. There was no budget. There was no contract. We were asked to approve the concept, and it would be, and it was actuated. And now we're being asked to have that $500,000 basically be 85% overhead and 15% direct rental assistance. And I remember, Heather, in June, you said 100% of the $500,000 we were going to give was for rental assistance. I just think 15% of our donation going to rental assistance is too small. So I can't support that percentage. I might be willing to support a bigger percentage or a smaller amount than 85% of the $500,000 for overhead. But I just think to ask the Desert Healthcare District to shoulder the entire shortfall in administrative costs is too much.
May I respond, Director Zendel? Because that's not actually correct. We did not say that the $500,000 that we were asking for in rental assistance would 100% be used for rental assistance. The initial $100,000 that you contributed to the Economic Protection Plan, 100% of that was used for directly for cash relief to residents. We multiplied that investment times 12 and absorbed all of our costs in getting over $1 million to residents in cash relief. as we took on the rental assistance we knew and was built into the budget of the cost extension, that it was going to cost money for us to be able to implement that program. So we included a small 5% administrative fee. And then at that point, we had only had $2 million in commitments towards rental assistance. And we leveraged that significantly where we now have passed $10 million to disperse to the community. So I understand your question, but I want to clarify that that's not what we said when there was a rental assistance cost extension. And as we explained, to be able to continue to pivot and aggregate these huge resources, that's why we made the modification request that we did.
So the contract and the budget, which I have never seen, you're saying had a 5% overhead, and now we're increasing it to 85%. I can't support that.
Conrado, were you going to?
I would like to highlight and invite our board members to look at this project as a collaborative effort. It's not only the district that is providing financial support. There are many organizations that are contributing to this project, some with less flexibility on how the funds can be used. And I believe that if we can offer that flexibility, is going to ensure the success on how these funds are going to be deployed and how the community will benefit from the rental assistance that we intend to provide. And also I believe that maybe I will make this comment at the end, but I want to acknowledge something that is happening in our community and how this project has been so controversial for some in the district, and even death threats have been casted at some of the staff at Lift to Rise. And I want to acknowledge that their effort is a significant effort for many people that depend on these dollars to stay in a home and to prevent the homelessness that some of them may experience without this support.
Thank you, Conrado. I second some of the sentiments that Director Zendel just shared. I asked a bunch of questions regarding what we have in front of us today on our agenda, just because some of the math didn't make sense to me and the way it was written. And I feel the same way that I'm not necessarily sure we should take on 80% of these operational costs. I would be okay lowering that to half of what we shared being given as operational cost. If we go down to the staff time, half of their time is being spent on this project, I think I would sit okay and well with half of it. And I think I would only sit okay and well with it if there was if the Lift to Rise team could tell us that yes, there's other funders who will also be shifting over their budgets. It is not, I feel a very large burden, I guess, from your proposal and your request today about the future.
Say that again, Karen, say it again. I didn't hear what you just said, please.
I feel like a very large burden. One of our responsibilities as directors of the district is to be fiduciarily responsible. And so since we've shared in this program, I feel a very large burden, one for our stake of the responsibility of the funds we manage. And then two, we only supported $500,000 of this. And now I feel that if we don't support the proposal in front of us, these $13 million, $10 million hinge on us moving our this proposal over. So I genuinely, same thing as Les, I feel very uncomfortable with what we have in front of us. And I feel a very odd burden for the third, the $13 million that is going out to people.
Is it okay if I respond, Vice President Borja?
Yes.
Can we hear from the board members first? rather than a tit for tat?
Sure. Give me a second, Heather. Please hold or take notes of your thoughts. Director Shore, can I start with you and then Director Yvette Perez Gill afterwards?
My only concern is the ratio seems disproportionate, all other things equal.
Thank you. Director Perez Gill? Any questions or comments?
I feel somewhat how you and Les feel. I don't feel that we should be taking on so much of the operational costs. I mean, that's just what I feel. Thank you.
Thank you. Director Rogers and then Director Matthews.
Well, I'm sympathetic with the idea of exceedingly large amount for overhead costs. But the reality is that this program is not going to work unless we support it. And it's an important job that that we've pegged enabled Lift to Rise with to complete. The numbers don't lie that they've received funding from other sources, and the only way to balance out their budget and to make it work is if we accommodate their request.
Thank you, Carol. Mark Matthews, Director Mark Matthews.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for Heather. So I'm a little confused, but I think I got it. Totally, you're going to bring in $13 million from all sources. Is that correct, or was it 10?
It will probably be more than $13 million, but including the county funding, yes, $13.5 million.
And do you know, off the top of your head, get me as close as you can to the county funding. How much would that be?
From all three contracts, about $13 million.
Oh, Jesus. So a lot of
million. Yes.
But the county will not provide any staff support.
The county is providing a 5% admin fee.
And we're providing an admin fee. So
a 5% admin fee. Yeah, and essentially what we're saying is that it's going to cost closer to 8 or 9% during the duration of the program.
Director Matthews, are you still talking?
No, I'm. You know, I'll tell you exactly what I'm thinking. On one hand, I'm going, here, there's $13 million we can help homeless people with, and geez, we absolutely have to do it. And I may support this, you got to somehow get funds to cover after 5%, I somehow feel sort of. I mean, you know the ground rules. This is what we've done. I don't want to not have money for homeless people in the East, anywhere in the district. But you got to cut your overhead. And in my view, I mean, and you don't have to do it today. But I think you're operating out of balance somehow, and maybe you can help us understand that at some point. But I think Greg had a question.
I'm going to ask, am I missing any other director? No, right? Dr. Zendel, Director Zendel, can I go back to you? I saw your hand up.
You want me to speak now?
Yes, please.
I would like to make an amendment that we increase our share of overhead from 5% to 30%.
What?
And you can do the dollars, but if what we're doing now is 5%, let's increase it to 30%. And I think Lift to Rise should go to the other funders and have them increase it too. Especially since basically the overhead you're saying is 9%. I think by going up to 30%, we're being very generous.
I'll second that because Dr. Zendel's a really smart guy.
Am I supposed to go back to the original person who motioned, Andrea?
Where's Jeff?
No, we would vote on the amendment. We would vote on whether to accept my amendment, and then
Carol will make the original motion. We have to make an amendment, not a whole new motion.
No, you know, you can vote on the amendment first.
They already voted on the original motion, so you mean they can vote now?
We haven't voted.
Thank you. You're correct. Thank you.
Okay.
So the proper thing to do is there any discussion on the amendment? And then if there isn't, then we vote on it.
Excuse me, it was from 10% to 30%, correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
No, 5% to 30%. Right now it's 5%.
Carol's got her hand up.
Carol, go ahead.
Thank you. I'd like to hear from Heather to see if that impacts their program in a negative way. Will 30% make it work for them?
Heather, could you answer Director Rogers?
Yeah, and sure. And I just want to say, we're incredibly grateful for all of the investments the district has made. Two, it's come up from multiple directors, other funders. We are actively fundraising with other funders to reconcile the gap. And the bottom line is it costs more in COVID in a crisis if we had had a year to put this budget together and figure out how to do this. But in any scenario, we're operating well under 10% to make this program possible. We'll continue to fundraise. We'll continue to go into our reserves. We went $500,000 into our own reserves to make the economic protection plan possible. And I think the place where I feel myself reacting a little bit is that we stepped up out of nowhere to aggregate resources and to push and make it possible for a significant amount of resources to be available. And in terms of just clarifying, we don't want to just disperse the amount of funding that's on the table. We want to continue to aggregate large amounts of resources so that folks who need them are able to have them. And it's the case we're trying to make with all of our funders is the more flexible backbone support that we have, the more that we're capable of turning on a dime and solving problems overnight, like for the 700 residents who weren't able to submit their apps this month because they don't have the technological capacity to be able to submit their applications. So just being honest, in any scenario, we're grateful for an increase. In any scenario, we're grateful for what you all have contributed. But I think that we've shown in the first part and now in the second part that we multiply, leverage, and aggregate resources. And so I hear what everyone is saying. I want to point out that what Matt pointed out is that the total cost to operate this rental assistance fund will be about $1.2 million. And so what we weren't asking was the district cover 80% of the total operating of it. But we're grateful for whatever contribution the district makes. The more money we have on the backbone side to be able to stabilize our own operational costs, the more money we're able to pull down and ultimately able to implement and much more quickly. But I hear what everyone says, and we're grateful for whatever decision the district comes to.
Thank you, Heather. At this moment, I am
all the amendment, please.
Yes, I'm going to ask for
a public comment. We didn't come for a public comment, Vice President Borja, but he's lowered his. Are you okay with that? With public comment?
Sure.
Go ahead, Greg.
Sorry, unmute myself there. So Heather just kind of addressed it. I think there's been a little confusion on the admin cost overall. If you look at what the reallocation amount is, it's not 85% of total admin costs for the implementation of the program. So, I mean, if you look countywide, you're looking at a $30 million program and a 5% admin cost. What Lift to Rise is asking is for a reallocation to assist. It's basically, if you look at the numbers on the $1 point some odd million, you know, would be about a 40 to 50% admin costs. I also want to emphasize too, go back to the data, that United Way of the Inland Valley is not doing any data collection. All of the countywide data is being done by Lift to Rise. And I will echo Heather's remarks that, you know, anything that the district has done, you know that I applaud everything you've done. And if this is the compromise, that's fine. But I just kind of wanted to give an overall view that I think we're getting stuck into this. This is 85% admin fees for the whole program. And that's really not the case. So thank you.
The 85% was what?
Margaret.
We were asked to pay of the $500,000. We were asked to have 15% of that go toward rental assistance and 85% go to administrative fees. That's the 85%.
For the portion of the district's contribution.
Right, I'm talking about the district. We're only talking about the district's.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. I understand less. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you. There's no more discussion. I'm going to call for a vote on Director Zendel's amendment.
The amendment was to increase the share cost from 5% to 30%. Is the amendment, is that correct, Director Zendel?
Yes, and that would be giving $150,000 toward administrative costs. 30% of $500,000.
Can you take a roll call for me, Andrea?
Absolutely. Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Zendel?
Yes.
Director Perestio?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
No.
Director Matthews?
I'm going to vote yes, but I think 30% of 500,000 is 150.
That's what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said 100. I'm going to vote yes.
I'm voting yes as well.
So the motion passes.
Thank you.
And can I make a comment? My fear is this, and Heather, I mean, you're in a real tough spot. You got a lot going on, and it's a very difficult time. And that's the reason I'm supporting this, because there's a tremendous number of people who are on the edge of falling off a cliff. And I think we're going to be back here sometime after the first of the year as this disease and everything else goes on in the economy, and then ultimately they are going to go off the cliff. And you know, the question is how much money and how much what. And maybe I've been home too long, but I just can't not help this group with the money we have now. But you're gonna have to find some more money somewhere else. Yeah. Thank you.
Go ahead, Arthur.
Well, you know, my reason for supporting Dr. Zendel's motion is really a little more complex. On the one hand, I agree with Mr. Matthews that I think people are very close to the edge. But I also believe that from an accounting point of view, overhead is not linear necessarily. There's got to be some economies of scale based on sheer volume of dollars. And number one. Number two, I think for us to connect, to put money that goes to literally impact someone's, I'm going to call it existence, is really the priority we have to address in terms of allocating our funds. We don't have an infinite amount of money. And if given a choice between putting the money into impact a human being and putting, or as an alternative, putting money into a budget, and budgets have lots of flexibility in it and lots of vagaries and lots of opportunities for consolidation, my default position is to put the money into impacting individual people. So that's the basis for my supporting Dr. Zendel's motion.
Thank you. Can we?
I call the question.
Go ahead, Dr. Zendel.
I call the question. Unless there's more discussion on the amended motion, we should vote on the motion.
Correct. Yes. So, Andrea, could you give us a roll call on the motion to support? important this.
Original motion. Okay. So the original motion was for the budget, the entire budget allocation. Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Zindel?
Yes.
Director Perezgio?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
No.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President Borja?
Yes.
Okay, and the motion passes.
Thank you, everyone. And thank you to the Lift to Rise team. Not just like a whatever thank you, like a genuine thank you. I did speak to an Indio resident who was telling me about your program, about the data you're all, like everything you've shared with us. Just know that as important as you all find it, we ourselves also find it important. And we have found it important since the first time you brought it to our attention that you were participating and moving in our communities in this way. We see it as important with every report you send out on a Thursday or a Friday evening that shows how many people from both ends of the Coachella Valley have been asking for funds. And you're right, like you stepped in a very difficult time, not just for Lift to Rise, but for everyone. And for that, like know that we don't sidestep that and know that we do see you. And also understand that we, any racist, anything that you need from anyone, terribly sorry that your staff have been receiving death threats. Like none of that is acceptable. All of that is shameful. And know that we stand with you in this motion and others to come to make sure that your staff and our community residents are supported, not just through COVID, but through anything else that's to come. So gracias. I'm gonna give the meeting over again to President De Lara.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice President Borja, for handling that. I had to leave abruptly because I had a puppy issue that was starting to make noise in the background. So I left a little bit prematurely than I was supposed to. And I just want to explain that my reason for
Leticia, we can no longer hear you.
You froze.
Leti?
Lost her.
We lost you.
But while we're waiting on her, Linda Evans said, she made a comment, I don't know if you guys happen to see that, that perhaps the district could utilize the contacts made by Lift to Rise to help educate the community about the importance of Census 2020.
Yeah. That's a good suggestion. Put it in the agreement. All right.
Uh-oh, where did she go? Let me text her. Maybe she can come back in and out.
Erin, why don't you go ahead with the agenda, please?
Yes.
We are on K1.
Yeah, I was going to take that over.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Vice President. The last but not least on your agenda tonight, certainly not least as far as Conrado is concerned, it's my pleasure to present to the board for consideration the 2020 amendment to Conrado's employment agreement. And the amendment provides an extension of Conrado's agreement from the term of his agreement, an additional 2 years from the current expiration date of July 31st, 2021 to July 31st, 2023. It also provides a 5% increase in his current salary. And otherwise, all the terms and conditions of the current contract remain the same. So are there any questions?
Nope. I would move approval.
Second.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Any public comments?
Call the question.
Go ahead, Director Zindel.
I just said call the question. Let's vote.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Just that means call the vote.
Oh, Andrea, would you mind giving us a roll call for this?
Yes, I will. President Dallara is trying to log back in. So, Director Shore.
Yes.
Director Zendel.
Yes.
What's going on?
That's Leticia logging in.
Yes.
Yes, Mo?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Matthews. Director Matthews votes yes, and I'd say leave the vote open until we hear from our president as well.
Certainly. Vice President Borham?
Yes.
So, okay, I'm going to let her know we're waiting on her vote.
Okay. And while we wait, I do want to say happy one-year anniversary, Conrado. We've been happy to have you as part of our team. Feels like we've moved mountains sometimes. I know your year with us has not been short of exciting and adventurous. Just want to say thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the trust and for the opportunity.
Speech.
Yeah.
Speech.
Did we move on to the legal update while we're waiting for
TCL? Yeah, we might as well. And the legal update, I'm sure you'll all be very disappointed, but I have nothing to report this evening.
No.
And hopefully next month we'll have developments from Sacramento. Thank you.
Thank you, Jet. Any immediate issues and comments from the board? Okay. Hearing none. I'm not sure what we do now. We just wait?
Well, we can just go to the foundation meeting until she comes back. How's that?
We would have to adjourn the district meeting.
No, we could not adjourn it. We could table the action until she gets back and then approve both at the other. So I move we table this meeting and then move to the foundation meeting until we can find our president in communication with us.
So you're saying to table the employment agreement for now until...
Well, no, I think we voted on the employment agreement. I think, and we heard the legal report. I'm not adjourning, but I'm at immediate issues, which are we have lost communication with our president. And so I'm suggesting we set this meeting aside until she's back and take up the foundation meeting because I'm really jonesing for a cocktail.
We're recessing board meeting.
Yeah, recessing.
Okay, so we are recessing the district meeting and we are going to continue on to the foundation meeting.
Yes.
Let me open up my agenda. Can I have a call to order for the foundation meeting, Andrea?
Roll call.
A roll call, please.
Uh-oh, I hit something. Just a second.
We can hear you, though.
Okay, just one second. I'm sorry. It happens.
I see you. I hear you.
Okay, Letty is calling me also right now.
Well, patch her in.
Hi, Letty. You can listen in and facilitate from here. Everyone can hear you. Or we're just going to recess and go on into the foundation.
Okay, I'm sorry. My internet is completely down. I tried two different computers, so I don't know what happened. Maybe there was a car accident or something. But I want to vote yes on the agreement and turn it over to Karen to adjourn and hopefully figure out what's going on before then we go into the foundation.
All right, your vote will be recorded.
Okay, sorry.
All right, we are adjourning the
district
meeting at 8:01 p.m. And we are starting the district's foundation meeting at 8:01 p.m. Andrea, can you give me a vote of attendance?
Director Shore?
Present.
Director Zindel?
Present.
Director Perez-Gill?
Present.
Director Rogers?
Here.
Director Matthews?
Here.
Vice President Borja?
Here.
And President DeLara?
Here.
I move we approve the agenda.
Second.
Thank you.
All those in favor?
All those in favor.
Hi.
I'm leaving the meeting for Lupisa.
Yeah. I was just trying to help.
Thank you. All right. Any public comments on the foundation meeting that don't have anything to do with an item on the agenda?
Any hands raised?
Thank you. Seeing and hearing none, do I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I move the consent agenda, including the financials.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Arthur. Moving on, Conrado, would you start us off with this?
And the vote is?
Oh, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Conrado, would you move us on to your CEO report, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Vice President Borja. I have a couple of items that are both related to environmental health in Eastern Coachella Valley. The first one is related to the contract we have with Concor Inc. On October 14, 2019, an illegal fire in Termal was reported in the news that severely impacted the Eastern Coachella Valley for several weeks. At the district meeting on October 22, Termal residents came to the meeting and provided some public comments and requested the district to intervene. We started working with Concor Inc. With a contract that was approved by the board. Concor has been connecting with key stakeholders at the federal, state, and local level to gather information on the thermal fires, tribal land use issues, and current response procedures. Some of those key stakeholders include the Congressman Raul Ruiz, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, CARP, California EPA, South Coast Air Quality Management District, the Torres Martinez Environmental Protection Agency, and Riverside County Department of Environmental Health. They are in the final stages of drafting a briefing paper with information gathered from various meetings and research that they have done. The briefing paper will include Eastern Coachella Valley environmental justice issues, chronology of thermal fires, tribal land issues and jurisdiction problems, the breakdown in communication and response, and an initial list of key stakeholders, entities, and potential representatives. This briefing will be disseminated in coordination with the Office of Congressman Raul Ruiz and, of course, the district. The next step will be to convene a series of collaborative meetings with key stakeholders with the objective of establishing a clear problem statement, improving communication amongst agencies and other collaborative members, identifying proactive steps to reduce risk of toxic waste burning, and developing an agreed-upon emergency communication plan. That's for that item. Any questions or comments?
Yes, Director Zendel.
Yeah, you remember in October of 2019 when the thermal fire, which kind of went on and on, one of the problems and one reason Congressman Ruiz asked us to get involved was that everybody was pointing fingers at everybody else, and nothing was being done. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was another fire, and I guess I'm asking, did it seem like the response to the fire that was on June 24th, a month ago, was it better, or did we see the same kind of nobody knows who's in charge response? Anybody know?
Well, it seems that this time it was better, and it took only a few hours to extinguish the fire.
and I know it wasn't as big a fire, but you learn from the small ones. You get better each time. So hopefully they're learning how to coordinate things better.
I also don't believe the June fire was on tribal land. And I know that adds a layer of complexity to putting them out, period. Any other questions from anyone else? Okay, I have a question myself. Actually, to be honest, it's kind of a concern. I'm concerned about this briefing paper being released and Concord not having spoken to community organizations, leaders in the region. I'm not sure what the briefing paper is going to say, right? I went back to our February board meeting and looked up the contract we had with them. There's several steps in here that I'm not sure if they've been able to conduct because of COVID, because of like working from home and them not being able to come down into the Coachella Valley. Item 1C in that February, in our contract with them, asks that they do have like steering committee meetings, that they're including local city, school, and other organizations. I would not, the criticism was very, very high about the way the fire was not handled. I'm not necessarily interested in putting out a briefing that does not include community members and what they believe are some of the answers. And again, I don't know what is in the briefing paper, so I may be very out of line here, but I don't feel that it's necessarily the next step. And it's not something that was included in our February contract with them to happen before having like the community steering committees and community conversations.
Yes, and I would say let's wait to see what the briefing has. I believe the document is going to be a technical briefing, but I would suspect that it will be wise to wait and see what's the content of the briefing.
I think if I may add, Vice President Borja, the briefing paper will include just a chronology of what happened and just kind of setting a historical perspective of some of the land use issues involving, you know, tribal members who are lattes, who are able to run businesses out of those, lots that are awarded to them through the Torres Martinez ban. But some of the things that I think, you know, to address your concerns of community members or community-based organizations being invited to provide their input, I think that is the next step that is highlighted in the last bullet point of our staff report, where we have identified, you know, an initial list of key stakeholders that does include organizations such as Alianza, Pueblo Unido, and other local organizations that have been working on environmental justice issues in the East Valley. And those organizations are gonna be part of the 6 meetings that are gonna start, you know, addressing some of the issues, who's gonna be responsible, what is that communication plan is gonna be, and how is that communication plan gonna be disseminated within the community. So I think the work that Concur is currently doing is just identifying the key players. And then they're going to bring everybody together to have, you know, those 6, you know, collaborative meetings to discuss some of these issues. And of course, you know, community input and community-based organization input is going to be very key in identifying some of the issues and hopefully come up with a communication plan that will be disseminated in case of an emergency in the future.
Thank you. What I'm trying to avoid is some of the criticisms I heard with the Barbara Poppy report. I was in the audience back then. I wasn't a board member then, but there was some comments that Barbara Poppy didn't talk to like very key people across the Coachella Valley that weren't government officials. So that's it. That's all I'm trying to avoid with this like report going out and it not having input from the community.
Definitely.
There's people who've been doing this work for many, many, many years that should not be overlooked.
Yeah, and we definitely heard your concerns about including some of these local, community-based organizations in the key stakeholder process. And we definitely made it a point to include those organizations and also some of the folks that they represent out in the community and they work with. So we'll also have that valuable input in the drafting of this communication plan.
Thank you, Alejandro. President De Lara, you're back.
I just wanted to make a comment on this. I believe that a key thing, a key component to this being a successful effort is the third bullet point under the Concur Inc. It says tribal land use and jurisdiction problems. That is key. If you don't have that, there's no more point in even moving forward. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that that we necessarily have to be at a point right now to be able to introduce that kind of information now. But I do think that at some point, in order to have a successful effort here, that we do have to be pretty close to having some acknowledgement or acceptance from the tribe of land use and jurisdiction issues being addressed. So I would like that to be something that is, that we ensure that there is buy-in and that there is a process that they're going to be taking to actually get some resolution or some progress on those things. Because if we're done in a year at the end of the six collaborative meetings and we don't have any idea of what are the next steps for those key things, like I said, it's not going to lead anywhere. So that was just my comment. So thank you very much for the effort, though, to inform us of how things are advancing in this project.
Thank you, President De Lara. It is in fact a key point in the work that Concur is doing. They have tremendous experience doing this in other jurisdictions, and it is a very sensitive topic. We're talking to a nation that has sovereignty, and we need to be very respectful and very sensitive to their needs and to the sovereignty of the nation, as we try to create a coordinated body to address challenges that are happening within their land and for which we in the outside have no jurisdiction. So we depend on having that respect and understanding of their sovereignty to gather the trust and the level of comfort to be collaborative in addressing the environmental challenges that happen in their land.
Thank you.
If there is no more question on this, the other item is AB 617. As you may recall, in 2017, Assembly Member Cristina Garcia authored Assembly Bill 617 to address air pollution impacts and environmental justice in our communities. It requires local air districts and the State Air Resource Board, CARB, to reduce air pollution in the most impacted communities. In 2019, the South Coast Air Quality Management District identified Eastern Coachella Valley as one of the priority areas for the implementation of AB 617. They appointed me as the CEO of the Desert Healthcare District to be one of the community steering committee members, and they also appointed Board President De Lara to be a member of the Community Steering Committee. The Community Steering Committee is meeting frequently. Right now, we are in the process of drafting the charter to regulate or to have an agreement on what are the rules of engagement of the Community Steering Committee. There are a couple of challenges that we're facing. One of them is getting South Coast Air Quality Management District to allocate funding for community members that are participating, and they should receive a stipend. And the other is that there is a friction in our community. Most members in our community desire that the charter includes that the meetings of the committees will be governed by the Browns Act, and South Coast Air Quality Management District is not very happy with that request. So there was a meeting last Friday with CARP, and CARP is working on a document that is going to provide better guidance on whether the meeting should be governed by the Browns Act. And the other point is related to the stipends, and they will try to support a standard number of stipends, or the standard number of dollars that the community members will receive as part of the stipend, and also the use of some of the funding for the implementation of this project. Any questions on that?
So the reason why this item is on the agenda, in addition to getting a report from our CEO, is the fact that at the last meeting, there was a discussion item about voting and non-voting members. And during that meeting, I just happened to look at the map and determine that I'm actually outside of the district. And I could still continue to serve on the committee, but I decided that rather than be one of those people that becomes controversial about voting, non-voting, I thought I would instead ask my fellow board member, Vice President Borja, to take over as the primary representative, in addition to our CEO, but the primary representative for the board, since she does live in the boundaries, and I will serve as her alternate. And I have been very interested in this whole process, even though there's several meetings a week, but I still will try to attend them because I think it's important for me to be informed. But I will follow our vice president's lead on her positions. I think Conrado summarized the main issues right now, and I've already made my positions known, but I will follow your lead, Vice President Borja, to make sure that we are not in opposition, but supportive of each other, as supportive of the spokespersons for our district. Okay, thank you. Next item on, is there any questions or comments from the board members at this time on any of those items?
Nope.
I see no questions. I will move on to the next item. And we have the first item, the minutes. Board Member Perez Gil, do you have any comments on item one or number two, the two information items?
No, thank you.
Okay. I will then turn it over to our grants manager to speak on number three, consideration to accept the $500,000 from the district to the foundation to further advance the district's role in addressing the healthcare needs of Black communities in the Coachella Valley. Donna, you have anything to add?
No, this is just what we discussed at the district side, and so it's just a more of a formal acceptance of allowing the $500,000 to be put into the foundation to grow this initiative.
Okay, so do we have any public comments on this item? Andrea?
No public comments.
Is there any questions from the board members? Any board member comments or questions?
Nope, but I'd like to move approval, Director Matthews.
Okay, we have a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
Director Shore seconds it. Is there any other questions or comments on this item before I call for the question? I see no questions, so I will call for the vote. Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Zendel?
Yes.
Director Perez Gil?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Okay, Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President Borja?
Yes.
And I vote yes. The next item on the agenda is number 2, Finance, Legal, Admin, and Real Estate Committee. This is an information item. We have the minutes that our chair of that committee brought our attention to earlier. So is there any questions or comments on that item from the board?
No.
Okay, there's no, we'll move forward then. The next item is the Homelessness Initiative. This is an action item. Number 1, consideration to approve a budget modification for grant 1034, City of Palm Springs matching grant for the Mental Health Housing Crisis Team and Wrap Around Services. Is this Donna, are you gonna speak on this?
Sure. We received a letter, as you see in your packet on page 24 and 25 from David Reddy, City Manager, City of Palm Springs. And due to the $47 million deficit from COVID-19 and the lack of funds coming in from tourism and hospitality, they cannot honor or will not honor their end of the grant contract to support mental health housing crisis teams and wraparound services. If you'll recall, when this grant was first approved back in November, December of 2019, it was to match what they already had in place of two mental health housing crisis teams and wraparound services with Martha's Village and Kitchen. And so now they do not want to, they cannot fiscally honor their end, but they want us to continue with our part of the grant and continue to support the one mental health housing crisis team and the wraparound services for $225,000. And they will continue to fund the two police officers and the community service officers that work with the wraparound housing crisis team. So it is up to the foundation board if they want to pick up the slack and continue with this, because the city is not. I think we should. That's staff recommendation, because we don't want to leave these people, homeless people, not without any kind of support services, and it has been a very successful program. I'm sad that the city will not pick up their end of the bargain, but anyway, we can still do our part.
Thank you, Donna. I have questions from board members Rogers and Zendel, and Borja. I will ask each of you, I'll call on you each of you, but first I'm going to open it up to public comments. Andrea, do we have any public comments?
Yes, Greg Rodriguez, you have the floor. There, Greg?
There we go, sorry. I just kind of want to echo Donna's comments, and I just want to let the board know that I'm working with Dr. Chang and RUHS Behavioral Health to, and this is more a medium to long-term goal about how we regionalize these outreach teams and hopefully access other sources of revenue to create, again, a valley-wide outreach team on this. But I think in the interim, to Donna's point, these have been very valuable. They work in close conjunction with county behavioral outreach teams, with Path of Life, with the CVAC Housing First Initiative, to really provide services. And so this bridge funding will really help. But I just wanted to let the board know that we are looking at some longer term solutions on sustainable funding. And, you know, Palm Springs is unique in the way that it's been hit by the COVID crisis, just because of the nature of what their revenue relies on as far as tourism. So I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you. Andrea, do you have any other public comments?
No, there are none.
Okay, I'm going to call first on Director Rogers and then followed by Director Zendel.
Thank you. I noticed that the grant itself is reduced only by one mental health housing crisis team. It looks like the Palm Springs is going to contribute 2 sworn police officers, funding 2 community service officers, and Martha's Village is going to take care of wraparound services. So that leaves one mental health housing crisis team. And I think that in this day and age of trying to figure out ways to assist our police and looking at ways to accommodate mental health housing crisis team, that we should adopt to contribute for that extra person, that so that we'll have two to continue the program.
Thank you. Director Zindel.
I think I'm going to say the same thing that Director Rogers said, that first of all, we only have 4 more months of the program. So it's not like we're funding all of the Palm Springs, the annual program that's left. And I wonder how much would be required to cover Palm Springs part of the second team, crisis team. And I want to remind everybody that the homeless people in Palm Springs basically represent those that in the West Valley that cannot get into, aren't able to go to the East Valley where we have 2 homeless shelters. So it's really serving the entire Coachella Valley. So my question, and Donna, I don't know if you can answer this, is one, how much would be required to fully fund it, the difference till the end of November? And 2, is the city willing to continue, if we fund it, to continue the 2 crisis teams? Or is that already water over the bridge or under the bridge, whatever the metaphor is?
Well, in the past, when this all first came up 3 or 4 years ago, there was 1 mental health housing crisis team, and they were very, very effective. And the wraparound services was continued by Martha's Village. They actually have space at Well in the Desert's place. So with 1, and just my opinion and just looking at what they've been doing in the past, 1 mental health housing crisis team has been working very efficiently. So, and as long as we're continuing the services and funding for Martha's Village and Kitchen for $75,000, that's a very important component. And as long as the city is still continuing the funding for the two police officers and the community service officers, they work hand in hand. So, I mean, they don't all go out as one group, you know, the whole housing crisis team with the police officers. They back each other up if they need it. If the housing crisis team can handle a problem without utilizing a police officer, that's fine. If police officers need to have the housing crisis team in. So in the past, it worked out really well with just 1, and I still think it will continue to work out with just if we continue just to fund the 1 until the end of November, and then we revisit it to see if, like what Greg was saying, we can make this more of a regional approach, because Palm Desert has got a mental health housing crisis team with the county, whether or not we split, you know, they're roving. So, but I think by us continuing to fund for $225,000, the 1 team, and at least most importantly, Martha's Village for the wraparound services, I think everything should be okay.
So what was the rationale of going to 2 teams? They must have thought 1 team wasn't enough.
You know, I don't really quite remember that, to be honest with you, Dr. Zindel, but they just wanted, this was a Barbara Poppy recommendation as well, and I think that because they saw the success of the 1 team, that they just thought if they could capture another team. But since then, we had the 25 familiar faces, which is now 100 familiar faces, and the funding for that. So there's been more funding coming down the line, and there's been more county. And Greg, back me up on this one if you can. There's been more county participation on a higher level, and not just having to fund 2 different teams.
I don't know if I'm unmuted or not, but.
You are.
You're okay.
Yeah, I would add on to Donna, and Les, a great question and great point is, when the second team was put into place, it was really, we hadn't ramped up the outreach from the CV Housing First as much as we have now. Additionally, the county has not only has actually added behavioral health outreach teams to the county overall since that time. And as Donna said, this was a recommendation of Barbara Poppy, which the county actually realized. And so I've been working really closely with Marcus Cannon and Dr. Chang in the Behavioral Health Department, not only in getting boots on the ground immediately, but on this long-term strategy approach. So I would agree with Donna that at this point, one team is fine. I will say too that we were not as, I don't know what word I want to use, but we really didn't, let me put it this way. We know more now where the pockets of homeless individuals with certain behavioral health problems, substance use problems are over this last year, way more than we did a year ago. And so while we've been able to, especially with the Project Room Key and all that, get people into hotels and services, is we realize too the number of people that don't want to accept services. Now that doesn't mean we won't keep interacting and outreaching to those, but to Donna's point, I do believe that the one team right now is sufficient, especially with the supplemental teams that the county has done, and then the further conversation of how we expand that on a regional approach.
And also with the additional of the cooling centers offering
exactly
services as well. So it's
I'll address that a little more later too.
Yeah.
Thank you. Director Zendo, are you finished with your comments and questions?
Yeah, I'm satisfied that it's okay. And I do support continuing this, even though Palm Springs isn't able to give their part of it.
Okay. Vice President Borja, you had your hand up.
Yes. So I went back to the November meeting notes that I have when the Palm Springs city manager joined us. We had a conversation, a couple questions for him regarding like police. I asked if homelessness was a crime, right? And he said no, it wasn't. I will just say that I'm incredibly disappointed at the breakout of who got let go or what part of this program got let go. I also went to Transparent California earlier today and saw that a police officer in 2018 was receiving just their salary over $100,000 on average for the city of Palm Springs, a sworn police officer. So these four police officers are, you know, the sum total of this whole project from the beginning. And so looking at some of the math that Les has done for us, right, like we only have a few months left, I'm really genuinely curious what the rest of this project would have cost the city of Palm Springs to continue participating in it, especially if it's say that it was working, especially after the conversation we had with the city manager back in November. That's no direction for staff or anything else. I'm just voicing my disappointment and concern in the way that this program, and I was not there for the conversation that the city council had with whomever they had about this particular project, but I will say I'm disappointed in the way the funds were allocated at the end of it all.
Disappointed with the district or disappointed with the city of Palm Springs?
Sorry, with the city of Palm Springs, not with us. With the city of Palm Springs.
Is there any other board member who has a question or a comment? Okay, is there a motion on the floor?
I move to accept the proposal.
I'll second.
The proposal is to fund one person for the amount of $225. Correct?
To continue our portion of the grant agreement.
Hi, Tina. Thank you for joining me.
That's correct. And Matthew's a second.
Okay, so we have a motion on the floor. Any other questions? Or comments?
Someone's bleeding in with some noise.
Yeah. Any questions or comments on the motion on the floor? Okay, I see none. Call for the question. All those in favor, Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Zindel?
Yes.
Director Perez Gill?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President Borja? And I vote yes. Okay, the next item on the agenda is information item, the summer cooling centers update. Is this Donna or Conrado?
Neither, it's Greg.
Okay, Conrado, I'll let you decide.
Thank you. It's going to be Greg.
Okay, Greg, you're it.
This is the whole reason I'm on the call tonight. But
we made you wait.
No, it's okay. Again, I want to thank the healthcare district, especially last year, who stepped up tremendously on this. And I never thought in my role I would be a shelter operator, but that's what I've become. As I've said before, you know, last year we had the riches of having locations and not the money. And this year it's been exactly the opposite. We've had the money and not the locations, except for Palm Springs. So where we're at right now is, as you know, we've transferred the Palm Springs site from the high school because anticipating they were going to open, which is not necessarily going to happen. But that's been moved to the Palm Springs United Methodist Church off Alejo. Operations are running really smoothly. Averaging about 27 to 30 individuals per night. No over demand on that, so that seems to be fine. We opened up a location, in Cathedral City about a week and a half ago now at the Elks Lodge. Logistically, that proved to be a little bit challenging, but is up and running and doing really well. We're averaging about 17 to 20 individuals there. Our biggest challenge was actually finding a location in Desert Hot Springs, and I want to really give a shout out to Director Rogers for assisting with this, but we had identified a couple sites and weren't getting calls back or they fell through, but we were actually able to reconnect with Kefion Shepherd, the pastor up there who provided the services last year, and was actually able, the challenges for this year was that because of COVID and the need to socially distance, the site we had last year was not adequate as far as in size. However, they were able to give us access to the other building on the site. And so working with CVRM, that will be up and running by the 31st. Again, all these sites have full showers, snacks, basically. But what we have found, what we found last year, is the overwhelming community support for meal delivery. What is nice this year versus last year is, as you know, last year we ran a 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. operation, which proved difficult because we really couldn't connect people to services because obviously county staff and our other service provider staffs don't operate from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. However, the Palm Springs operation is running from 3 p.m. to 7 a.m. Cathedral City and Desert Hot Springs will run from 5 p.m. to 7 a.m. So I've been able to work with Tom Cox and the CV Housing First program now that these are up and running, or Desert Hot Springs will be up and running, to get our Path of Life contracted outreach people out to those sites on a regular occurring basis to link people up to services. What we are also doing is I'm working with our my counterparts within the county who have been operating the Project Room Key program, which most of you know the county launched way before the governor even announced about housing homeless individuals in hotels and motels. We've housed over 400, or we've roomed over actually 600 and some odd individuals in the past few months. So we've actually permanently placed about 75 people to date. But we're actually working with them on how we can transition some of the individuals from these overnight cooling centers into the Project Room Key program. Some of you may have known that we closed the entrance into that program a couple weeks ago. However, we have opened that back up due to some creative work by our housing authority and homeless solutions department on accessing funding for that. So what we want to do is be able to transition people from these overnight centers into the Project Room Key, where we then are developing an action plan for movement to permanent supportive housing and other housing options. And additionally to the CVAG Housing First program is utilizing our crisis stabilization units to do the same thing in transferring those people. So we're very excited about where this has gone. What I really am proud about is that we've gone from last year an emergency overnight you know, cooling situation to this year where it's the same thing, but we've really expanded the operations to how do we get these people into services, wraparound services, healthcare, behavioral health, substance use, but more important, permanently housing. And so we're happy with where that is. Happy to take any questions you may have.
And if I could give a shout out to Greg, he was voted as the chair of the continuum of care for Riverside County. So I know he's going to be working very diligently, getting more money here into the Coachella Valley.
Well done.
Well done, Greg.
Thank you, Donna. And I will say, and again, the Desert Healthcare District has been one of the lead partners on the whole collaborative approach to homelessness. And, you know, my election to this position, my relationships, with the new, I still have trouble getting the name of the new department, but the Housing Homelessness Prevention and Workforce Solutions Department, that's it, is really going to be beneficial as we move forward. And I know I updated you last meeting on the approval of the kind of sub continuum of care for the collaborative. And so I'm working very hard right now to finalize what that organizational structure will be. But thank you, Donna, for the shout out. I'm really very excited about where we're moving as a continuum of care. I'm really excited about how the county has reorganized the department and is really focusing more on not just reporting numbers and funding opportunities, but how we do best practices, how we do more collaborative regional approaches. And what we've been talking about over the last 2 years, especially with the help of the Desert Healthcare District and Barbara Poppy, we're really seeing the realization of Barbara's report. And if I could just add on too, is I've been working nonstop, as many of you probably are aware, the governor announced the kind of the I don't know if you want to call it stepchild or the next iteration of Project Room Key, but it's Project Home Key, which is an investment of over $500 million by the state into hotel and motel acquisitions for permanent supportive housing, primarily to transition many of the individuals from Project Room Key into permanent housing. I have been working aggressively over the last, and you know this because I reported it on the last healthcare district meeting and was reported in the Desert Sun, that we are identifying hotels within Palm Springs. We probably will not be using the Travelodge, although it's still on the list. So we do have three hotels. We will be having a special meeting of the CVAC Homeless Committee next week, but more importantly, the City Council of Palm Springs is holding a special meeting. I believe the announcement will come out tomorrow, announcing a public comment session and hopefully approval by the city for the county to move forward on acquisition of a property, as well as rehabilitation, and then some allocation of some of Palm Springs HAP money for the acquisition. I'm very excited about the potential for 85 to 90 units of not only permanent supportive housing, but transitional housing and possibly some respite care beds, a workforce opportunity with a restaurant on site, and then eventually, hopefully, developing a navigation center. So, you know, all of this stuff we've been talking about for 2 years now, that in most jurisdictions, to be honest with you, have been 5 to 10 year operations, we are going to be realizing within the next 6 months to a year. So very excited about it. And again, I cannot thank the district enough for the support that you've had, and will encourage, of course, your ongoing support in matching programs and other funding of initiatives as we move forward.
Thank you, Greg. And I do not know how you're going to find another hour in the day to take on this new responsibility, because you are a very, very busy man. And I appreciate all the work that you're taking on and that you're doing, and the partnerships that you are developing out here on the behalf of all these nonprofits and ourselves. So thank you. Are there any other board members that would like to make a comment or a question on this item? Carol, Director Rogers, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay.
You're welcome.
No other comments or questions? Then we will move on to the next item is old business, Coachella Valley Information Place, CVHIP Analytics and Trends. This is an information item. I'll turn it over to our CEO.
Thank you, Madam President. This is a brief information item you will find on pages 26 and 27 of the board packet, and we have Alejandro Espinosa and Will Dean on the Zoom meeting, that, and they will provide a brief overview of this item.
Great. Thank you, Conrado. Just wanted to provide the board a quick update on what is happening on the analytics side. I'll provide you all with a, you know, as you can see on your, on the staff report, some of the analytics for CVHIP since the launch of the public marketing campaign, which was on the 15th of April. on the analytics side, you can see that there was a spike. We originally started with 600 monthly users on the, excuse me, of the platform and peaked at 1700, which, you know, we knew that naturally that peak was gonna come back down, but we have maintained 750 monthly users since that trend has been on a downward spiral since the initial launch of the campaign, which is great. We're averaging about 750 monthly users to the platform. And, you know, still some of the most frequently searched terms continue to be food. That's always our number one. We see that at 52%. COVID-19 was at 22%. And that was because of a lot of community members searching for COVID-related services, which was a great thing that we did identify organizations that were providing COVID-19 services on the early onset of the shutdown. So that was a really good thing that, you know, we knew that community residents were going to be searching for COVID-19 resources. So we were forward thinking and added, you know, those tags to services. Another one that, you know, coincides with some of the topics that we were, you know, discussing earlier today, which is housing and rental assistance. They respectively came in at 15% and 11%, and then 1% on money and work. You know, the usage of CVHIP itself by cities, we see that Indio is the number one city that utilizes CVHIP, given our analytics, followed very closely by Palm Springs, Cathedral City, Desert Hot Springs, and then the city of Coachella. You know, those have pretty much have remained steady. Some of the things that we've done on the marketing side that I could speak of, and then Will could address some of the things that he's been working on with KSQ and Telemundo, is that we have opened up a CVHIP Facebook page where we're going to be posting resources, you know, and highlighting certain community based organizations and also providing links to where they could find additional information on CVHIP. We're also thinking of, you know, distributing a newsletter, which is going to help a lot of these service providers that are using CVHIP on a regular basis to just kind of give them information about new features that are being rolled out every so often. So we wanted to make sure that we continue to be engaged with some of those organizations and individuals that have received a presentation by me, or they heard about, you know, CVHIP through one of our, you know, community events or presentations that we've done prior to the COVID epidemic. Now we're doing a lot of digital presentations. You know, I presented with Diane Vines with the Cal State University San Bernardino street medicine program. So that is something that the students are gonna be utilizing where they're doing their street outreach starting here in the fall. I'm also coordinating with Greg to provide this training to the cooling center staff so they could also be aware of all the different services that are within CVHIP. So they could also start working in connecting those folks that come to the cooling center with additional services that they might not be able to provide there within the cooling centers. And lastly, you know, I did have a presentation with Derribando Barreras, which is an East Valley group that utilizes ambassadors to disseminate, you know, key messaging within the East Valley communities of Mecca, North Shore, Termal, Oasis, and Coachella. So I did have a really good presentation with them, which was recorded in Spanish, and they were able to post it on their website. And to the date, I believe they had 400 views on that particular video where I presented. So we are trying to get a little bit creative on our outreach, since, you know, the traditional outreach prior to the COVID, it was me going and doing presentations to large groups, to smaller groups, and to different service providers on the different features and capabilities of CVHIP. So now we're trying to do that digitally through Zoom presentations, and they're kind of working, but obviously it's not as good as a one-on-one presentation as we did before. So, and now Will could, you know, talk about some of the things that we've been working on the KESQ and Telemundo public marketing campaign.
Actually, I really don't have the much to add. As you see in the staff report, we're in our fourth month of the campaign, broad digital campaign from social media to radio and TV. That's expected to run through January 2021. And you may recall that we also had reached out to some independent media outlets, Spanish language and English language media outlets. We were able to work with three of them. A couple of them were not able to work with us at this time, but we're still trying to identify other outlets we can reach out to and help us reach an even broader market than Telemundo and KESQ. So any suggestions are welcome.
Thank you, Will and Alejandro. Are there any board member comments and questions? If you could raise your hand. I see one, maybe, but I'll go ahead and call you anyways. Anybody else? Okay, Vice President Borja.
I just am wondering if we know what people mean by like money, like people.
With on that search, that I think it was more on unemployment benefits. You know, those are, you know, what I'm able to extract from the analytics that we receive for our CVHIP landing page and search boxes, is I'm able to extract what are the words that they utilize. But, you know, some of our community partners, that's part of the presentations and training that I do, is to ensure that programs like Lift to Rise have the appropriate tags on their program profiles. So when a community member is searching for money, you know, they are connected with the appropriate resources, and then the search engine, the algorithm, without getting too nerdy or technical here, the algorithm will pick up whatever they type in, and then any program profile with money as a tag will appear in those search results, and hopefully they'll find whatever they're looking for.
Thank you, Alejandro, and thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments from any board members? Yeah, I don't see any hands going up. So thank you, Alejandro. Thank you, Will. And thank you, Conrado, for giving us that update. And that brings us to a close. Any comments or questions before we adjourn? I don't see any. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry for my technical issues earlier. I have to agree with Greg and Mark that, Andrea, you do a fantastic job. And thank you, Karen, for handling directing of the meeting in my absence. I really appreciate all of you. Everyone have a good evening, and I will talk to you later. Take care and be safe.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye now.